We're going to start the meeting. We've got a lot
to do next today, Friday, and Monday. And we do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to start testimony. And the first thing that's going to happen is that we are going to get a brief introduction to the bill from Representative Atkins. And then we have a number of people that are signed up to testify. We'll hear from them, and then we'll come back this evening and have a more in-depth presentation from staff who are happy to be testifying right now before the Senate. And there'll be plenty of time for questions this evening, tomorrow, and not so much time on Monday, because Monday we're going to vote on the amendments in the bill. And I would just remind members that the Affordable Care law is the law. We're not debating whether it is a good law or a bad law. We are debating how Minnesota will adapt to that law. And number two, we are not debating whether there will be an exchange. There will be an exchange. And if we don't do a Minnesota exchange, there will be a federal exchange. So I will just remind members that if you vote against this bill, ultimately on Monday, you will be voting for a federal exchange. So, and I would move that House File 5 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Taxes Committee. I can't move that, I've been told, because we don't have a quorum. But Representative Atkins, if you would start presenting your bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. We also have, there were a few changes that were made last night in the State Government Finance Committee. So I'm going to do a relatively brief walkthrough of the bill, and I will try to highlight some of the changes that are not official yet because they haven't been engrossed into the next version. But if you've got the copy of your bill handy, and you don't necessarily need it, but the section on page 1, line 112, is simply the title. Line 1.14 is a bunch of definitions, all of which speak for themselves. That's by nature their definitions. Line 2.19 is the just the establishment of the marketplace. An application of other laws that allow the relative to open meetings and so forth. Line 3.35 is description of the governance. It's a 7-member board, 3 that are sort of industry appointments, 3 consumer appointments, 1 department commissioner, all by the governor, subject to confirmation in our version of the bill by both the House and the Senate. In the Senate, they are simply subject to confirmation by the Senate. They will serve, they'll be initially appointed and then serve staggered terms. Responsibilities and powers of the insurance marketplace is to set up, and I think a lot of folks are familiar with what we're talking about here. It's a online competitive marketplace where people can, on an apples-to-apples basis, shop for their health insurance. It will allow them to avail themselves of federal tax credits, as well as benefit from a good, robust amount of competition that, quite frankly, right now in the marketplace, and I'm a small employer myself, it's gall darn hard to shop for health insurance and feel like you've got any sort of leverage whatsoever to buy it. If you're a big employer, I get it. You probably got a little bit more leverage than I do. But as an individual or as a small employer, there's just not a lot of leverage there when you go shopping for it. So if you get everything in one place and it's an apples-to-apples comparison, these aren't my numbers, by the way. There's expectations that 1.3 million Minnesotans will buy their insurance through the marketplace, that 70% will save money as a result of two things. One is enhanced competition. The second is the ability to avail themselves of the federal tax credits. Average savings are expected to be in the neighborhood of $490 per family, but upwards of $1,700 for some families dependent upon income. And then there's folks like my family that wouldn't be able to get anything. Yes, sir.
I have to interrupt because we now have a quorum, and so I call the meeting to order, and I've been informed by my staff that I do not know anything about parliamentary procedure.
And when is that?
We cannot, I cannot move the bill because we do not have possession of it. It will probably go through the House floor that session today, and we will have it this evening. And so this is an informational hearing, and but we will have, when Representative Atkins gets done, we will have, we got about 10, 12 people signed up to testify. And Representative Loftus has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not only do we maybe in committee not have possession of the bill, but we as members do not have a copy of the bill. So just so you understand, Representative Atkins, when you're saying line 2.2 and blah, 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 we literally do not have here in our packets the typical House research summary, the language. And so as you're going through things, you're probably going to help a little bit with more explanation, just because for people who haven't, there might be some people here who haven't heard it before. we just don't have the basics.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I've actually somewhat departed from that. I realized when people didn't pull anything out of their packets that that was probably the case.
We will. I assume we will have that this evening. And Representative Abler has a comment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and want to welcome everybody back. Actually, I noticed the crowd is smaller than in the previous committee when I sat in on this. And I don't know if it's. I just am curious about the lack of enthusiasm, but just to kind of, since the crowd is smaller, and one of the comments in the first hearing was that by the end of these testimonies, people could recite each other's testimony. Mr. Chair, perhaps to save time, the author could just give the testimony of all the witnesses, since he's heard it so much, and offer and even debate their views for us, and then when we get through with that, then we could proceed to our own questions. Just a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Atkins,
I probably could, but you know, I'm sure that they've adapted and have additional thoughts and ideas that we probably ought to.
Representative Atkins, maybe you could remind us how many committees this has been through before it got here.
140, Mr. Chairman. I think I've actually appeared in front of the legislatures in Iowa and Wisconsin. It feels like I've been everywhere, Mr. Chair. I want to say about a half dozen now. I have inquired as to what the record is, and we're awaiting that. I believe it's 11. So if need be, based on the amount of paper we've gone through, maybe we'll go to the Ag Committee or the Environment Committee or something like that as well, just for kicks, if it will secure the record.
Representative Atkins, I'd like to thank you for putting a lot of people in my part of the state to work processing paper.
It's all about the timber industry, Mr. Chairman. where I left off, we talked a little bit about the impact on consumers. Arguably, it's got an even greater impact on small businesses in Minnesota and businesses generally. The anticipated savings are over $150 million annually as a result of not having to pay the MCHA assessment. Minnesota Department of Health also recently released on Thursday a figure of another $150 million that's saved as a result of not having to deal with uncompensated care issues. So we're talking about over $300 million. And then on top of that, the anticipated savings as a result of enhanced competition are an additional 7.5% for small businesses that purchase their health insurance through the exchange. As far as how it's going to get sold, who's going to sell it, as a consumer, you can go online, you can buy it yourself. Or you can avail yourself of some help from an in-person assister, a navigator. Now, these folks are not agents or brokers. They're not going to be able to give you insurance advice, but they can help you navigate and walk your way through the website. Specifically, though, we are not putting agents or brokers out of business. The point here is to actually, if it's up to me, I'd suggest to you that with 300,000 currently uninsured Minnesotans expected to purchase their coverage through the exchange, that there might actually be greater opportunity for agents and brokers. And one of the things that they told me was quite critical to them was that under the original bill, they were compensated through the exchange, and like that very much. We took that portion out, and according to their representatives, that has addressed about 90% of their concerns. They will continue to be compensated in the traditional fashion, which is you sell a plan, you're compensated by the carrier. Next topic that has been of concern is who's going to be allowed to sell products in this health insurance marketplace. There's three criteria or three levels that folks have to clear. The first one is just your basic Department of Commerce kind of FDA approval sort of thing, that it's safe for consumption. Doesn't go much further beyond that, but it's just kind of consumer safety type level. The second is a certification requirement. The feds require the board would have an ability to set the standard for what products are allowed in. And then the final piece is what has been termed an active selector element, where the board would have an opportunity to go through the products that have met that certification and then try to get an even enhanced, a further enhanced value added by as a result of saying, you know what, we like these products, but these are the ones that we're going to choose and allow for sale in the exchange. And try to drive an even better product to be available in the exchange. I'm sure that we will have considerably more discussion about that, Mr. Chair, so I'm going to leave that where it's at for now. Data practices is somewhat of note for this committee, I'm sure, but in particular it's a subject for the Data Practices Subcommittee, and I want to publicly thank them. They put on an amendment last night. Chair Simon and Representative Holberg, as well as others on that committee, worked very closely together and came up with some really good language. It is not yet in the engrossment. It will be as of this afternoon when we get through the House floor again. Dramatic improvement. I am not a data practice. I care about it a great deal, but I'm no expert on it, and I really want to thank Chair Simon and Representative Holberg for all their work to put together some much greater protections for data that will be reflected in the bill yet this afternoon. The rest of the bill is mostly administrative. It's where the funds are going to be, a report to the legislator. We have made this subject now to the and demands a review by the legislative auditor on an annual basis, who will report to the legislature. The way that it's paid for is with a 3.5% withhold. So if you pay $1,000 for your health insurance through the online marketplace, $35 of that would be withheld to pay for the operations of the marketplace. And Ms. Kmit has been kind enough. I asked her about, because some talk about this will cost more to purchase a health insurance policy. But what it does is it substitutes for the enrollment, the eligibility determinations, and all of the things that the health insurers are currently having to do. And the reason I thank Ms. Kmit is because I've asked her and she's agreed to try to find out what that cost is for the health insurer. Because obviously there's going to be some savings as a result of not having to perform those duties. When people do this, they literally go online, go through the selection stuff, pick out their plan, and they're enrolled. So there is no more eligibility determination, there's no more enrollment stuff. All of those administrative elements no longer need to be done by the carrier. And whether that's a 2% savings for the carrier or 6% savings, I don't know that, but I've asked Ms. Kmit if she can find out, and she's pledged to me to try to find that out. I hope and I suspect that the up to 3.5% withhold that we have in the bill and the amount of savings by the plans might actually offset one another maybe save them a little bit of money. We'll find out. And it bears noting that under the federal exchange, it is an arbitrary 3.5% withhold. There's no wiggle room with respect to how much it's going to cost. Under our plan, it's up to 3.5%, and under our latest numbers, it's going to be somewhere between 2 and 2.5%. So considerably less, rather than $35 a month, which would be guaranteed through the federal exchange, we're talking maybe 22, 25, somewhere in there, which on a monthly basis, you add that up over the course of the year, you're saving a lot of money compared to what we'd end up with otherwise, which is a federal exchange.
We have a question from Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Atkins. You know, as far as those savings are concerned on underwriting, one of the concerns I've heard is that what they save on underwriting will be more than offset by not having any underwriting, and therefore people with large claims can simply sign up for the plan that they want, which would offset any underwriting savings. The other thing is, because the premium less their subsidy might be more than the penalty for not having insurance, the other concern is that people will simply pay the penalty until they have a major health problem and then sign up for the health insurance and be able to collect because of that claim. So any perceived savings will be more than offset by not having what traditionally has been economic principles of underwriting that kept health insurance policies healthy for the majority of the people. And in Minnesota, of course, we have the MCHA alternative, which has been an excellent, well-working alternative for people who are unable to get health insurance due to health conditions. So just comment briefly would you on the concern about paying the penalty and waiting until you have a major health problem and then signing up for the health insurance if the penalty is less than the subsidy and the premium that you actually have to pay?
Just before, the question should be restricted to just clarifying what, at this time, you'll have plenty of time this evening and Friday to ask more detailed questions. I will say that probably 90% of the public is in favor of getting rid of pre-existing conditions. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, and I can be very brief because Representative Grunhagen has identified an issue that he has with the Affordable Care Act generally. It's not impacted one way or another as a result of the marketplace, having an online marketplace. I share the concern that you have, Representative Grunhagen, but doing this won't impact it one bit.
And then we have a question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a couple, but Representative Atkins, as you were kind of reading off and analyzing sort of the potential assessments against the insurance industry and the potential savings in their administration, since the bill provides for the phase-out of MCHA, which is also has an assessment on the insurance industry in the fully insured market, won't that also be a savings that we should factor into to figuring out what the real net impact is?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, absolutely. I sort of alluded to that, but the fact is it's a big, from somebody who pays it, it's a lot of money. And by virtue of that going away, at the same time we've got enhanced competition and the availability of tax credits. I should point out, by the way, on Representative Grunhagen's point, is there's a full expectation that as a result the guaranteed issue, and you can't deny people, and you got to take all kinds of folks that previously were uninsured. I think there's study after study that shows there's an expectation that premiums are going to go up as a result of the Affordable Care Act. As a result of this, however, there's no question that for most folks they're going to go down. And that the point that you made is one of the reasons that they'll go down for business. But there's a whole bunch of reasons they should go down for 70% of consumers as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, because I think that, you know, that's another piece in the puzzle. But the other thing I would ask you to do is just to, because this is the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, really talk a little bit more on the role of the exchange in terms of the people that we're concerned about. We heard testimony earlier that 700,000 of the 1.2 million that will initially use the exchange will actually be our MA applicants. And then there's another group of people who will qualify for premium assistance, which is a new federal program that will help people afford private insurance. And so can you talk a little bit more about the financing on that part of the exchange where the majority of enrollees will be and that we're going to deal with in terms of, you know, what is the financing mechanisms for the navigators, for the counties who will continue to play a role in enrollment? How will the administrative costs of that system get, how is that factored in here? Is it all in one exchange budget? Where does the federal money come in? That would just be helpful.
Yeah. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I realized as you were asking the question I should have taken notes. So if I miss, it's a multi-pronged question. There's about 690,000 folks that are expected to be able to get into public programs as a result of this. And that's part of the reason that we set it up the way that we did. Initially, we actually talked about having it just be a nonprofit separate from the state of Minnesota. Then we realized that people wouldn't be able to enroll in the public programs as a result. And from the feds, that's what we've heard. And for our own sake, we want it to be a streamlined kind of one-stop shopping for people to get their insurance. So we've got sort of this hybrid Minnesota Zoo or PUC, Public Utility Commission, sort of entity that will be sort of an offshoot of the state. But we'll be able to get people enrolled. In terms of how that functions, we've got navigators and in-person assisters who will, as part of that 3.5% withhold, those folks are going to be out in the communities. It's community action networks. It's folks at our counties. It's others that have these built-in networks already with people, those 300,000 uninsured folks, those 690,000 that are expected to get their access to public programs that have those existing networks. And what the board will be doing is entering into arrangements with those navigators, which are not individuals, they're entities, with those entities and those in-person assisters to compensate them at a reasonable rate for their efforts. to try to encourage and make sure that people have the help that they need. It's interesting to note, folks will talk about this as being Travelocity for health insurance. It's not. It's still complicated stuff. This is health insurance. It's that's why agents and brokers, I think, will continue to have a role. And just working your way through a website and answering all the questions and going through the stuff that's necessary to get there, those navigators and in-person assisters will play a vital role as well. But that's all covered. There's no general fund dollars. It's all covered. It's a standalone, self-supporting operation, using that up to 3.5% withhold. I hope that answered the series of questions, but I probably missed a little bit.
Okay. No, sorry about
Representative
that,
Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Apkins. Well, I actually think there's actually another component into the budget, and that is actually the federal funds that come that will be supporting a major portion of this, both in terms of the development and also in terms of the enrollment of people in MA. And I do believe that the majority, at least initially, and perhaps continuing, of the enrollment will actually be done by the people who are currently doing it, which is county staff throughout the state of Minnesota, in addition to the people doing it on their own online who want to qualify, who may qualify for MA and enroll themselves onto MA, and the navigators. We do have navigators now in a program that the Department of Human Services operated, but they tend to reach out to specialized populations, and they do a really good job of doing that. But when someone's being discharged out of jail or prison, or they're in the emergency room, like at HCMC, there are county enrollment staff there to help them sign up for the programs. You know, that function, I think, is going to continue pretty much as it does right now, but I'm still a little bit confused about the federal funding and the local property tax and how that all blends into the future. And if, as this continues in this committee, it would be great if we could get that clarified, and I'm sure the Department of Human Services could help us figure that out, because I'm a little confused.
Okay, we have a question from McDonald, and then after your response, then I'm going to let Representative Atkins finish his presentation on the entire bill.
Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, you mentioned in your information that the cost will go down for the premiums and the health care, and just wondering, it seems that just to establish the exchange, as Representative our chairman said yesterday, that it's very complex. There's a lot of moving elements. It's continuing to moving. So we understand and recognize that it's going to be very costly to implement the exchange. And yet it'll duplicate offices and agencies such as the Department of Health and Commerce and DHS. So I'm wondering, with the amount of cost that is going into it and just the cost to run the exchange every year at approximately $52 million a year, how is that going to lower the cost, and then where do you get your numbers? Where can I get my numbers that indicate the cost will go down to Minnesotans?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
McDonald, again, I probably should have taken notes because you folded a number of pieces. We don't expect there to be duplication of services, number one. During the period of transition where there's a handoff from MMB to the board, and we also expect Department of Commerce to work with and Department of Health to work with the board, but we don't expect them to be doing the same thing. And to the extent the county folks are helping folks get enrolled, we don't expect there to be a duplication of services, other than at the very startup, we expect there will be a little bit of transition period that will take place. In terms of cost savings, I expressly said that some will save, some will not. The way that consumers will save, and I apologize for repeating, but consumers are expected to save as a result of enhanced competition and then being able to avail themselves of the tax credits. That's true for about 70% of families, and the average family will save, according to Jonathan Gruber. Dr. Gruber is an MIT economist, and he's considered by just about everybody the foremost economist relative to health economics in the country. He's indicated that he anticipates the average savings for a Minnesota family be in the neighborhood of $490. Now, for my family, we make a little bit above what the high point is. We wouldn't be able to get any of those tax credits. But you know what? Me and my business, I suspect, will benefit tremendously from being able to have a little bit more competition for our business, where we can do an apples-to-apples comparison. And according to Dr. Gruber and the modeling that he's done, the average small business is going to save about 7.5%. Not a huge amount, but everything counts when I'm trying to grow my little business, my little law firm in South St. Paul. So that's where the anticipated savings are expected to come from. And I apologize if I missed any portion of your question, but I've done the best that I can.
Representative Donald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative. No, that you answered it a little bit. Of course, a savings is a great thing. I'm a small businessman myself, and I'm looking for savings. I got off the phone with a friend of mine who's a union here in St. Paul, and they're very concerned with the cost going up. They are told that the cost will go up considerably, and there won't be a savings. And I'd like to assure them that, no, this is good for Minnesota. Perhaps the savings will be. Where can I get those numbers that you cite, that there will be a savings of $490 in the average family for Minnesotans? Where can I get those numbers so I can educate myself, so I can communicate that to my constituents and those who have concerns?
Sure.
Representative Atkins, but I will say, Representative McDonald, that we'll have testimony this evening from April Todd Monmouth, and to discuss the Gruber report. So, but if you had a comment, and then I'm going to let Representative Atkins finish his presentation of the bill.
And Mr. Chair, that's exactly what I was going to reference. I think we're talking two different things, though. The increase in premiums is actually as a result of the Affordable Care Act, and I've seen all those numbers. I'm sure you have too. Anticipated increases of 15% to 29% in the cost of health care. But everything through the exchange is designed to bring those costs down, because you can get the tax credits, you've got additional competition, you've got an apples-to-apples comparison, and that's what we've asked Dr. Gruber to take a look at, is what will be the impact of shopping through the exchange. There's two reports. He did a report in April. We had that updated in December. You've got the final report. You've got all of the final information and conclusions. The only thing that we are waiting is the textual that wraps around that I suspect is going to explain about the same way we have what those conclusions are, but in a textual fashion.
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up.
We're going to have to move along here, but to ask your question,
thank you.
Keep it brief.
I see those numbers as well from the Gruber-Gorman report, and I know they're doing a follow-up. Right now, their initial report has increases up to 26% to 42%. So I won't expect you to answer the question, Representative, but I do look forward to the enhanced version of the Gruber-Gorman analysis that gives us those numbers that you speak of, that there will be a savings to our Minnesotans and to people in my district that I work for.
Representative Atkins, why don't you finish your presentation?
Mr. Chair, that's about it. The effective date is the last portion of the bill. So I appreciate the questions and the opportunity to present the bill.
And thank you, and we'll see you again this evening. And Representative Grunhagen, but we're going to have to go move on to let people...
Yeah, real quick. Real quickly, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you know, I find it interesting your assertions about lower costs for small groups. I went to a local chamber luncheon or dinner in my district just the other night, and I sat by a small business owner, and he has he's right on the border between 49 and 51 employees, and he figured his cost under the ACA, and if he's above 50 employees, it's going to cost him, just on current premiums, $16,000 additional a year as a small employer. So you can bet he's going to stay under 49 employees, okay? So this mandate that's coming down is going to drive total premiums up for our small businesses rather than lower them in terms of their overall cost. One additional example, just for food for thought for you, I also had a business administrator from my school from one of my school districts in my district, and I encourage everybody to check with your school district. They figured up the ACA cost for their school district, and this is a smaller rural school district, was $197,000 of additional cost for their school district. The penalty, and by the way, the guy's name is Patrick Guggen. He said I could use his name publicly and the information. The penalty for not doing it was $218,000 a year. They can't afford that. And what they're going to have to do is take employees who are working with children struggling academically and reduce their hours or lay them off completely in order not to pay that additional penalty. So the intent of the law is good. The actual results of the law is, both in our schools and our small businesses, you're driving costs up, and you're going to have less employees, and kids who are struggling are not going to get the help they need in our school districts. Please check with your school districts on those statements.
Representative Atkins, you do not have to answer that question. That question relates to the Affordable Care Act. We are not debating the Affordable Care Act in this committee. We are debating this bill, which has to do with the exchange. And Representative Moran, you have a question. Moran.
I see that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I had a question regarding the agenda for committee, the hearing on this bill. Will we have an additional opportunity to ask Representative Atkins questions about issues that are raised by the testifiers?
He'll be here tonight. He'll be here Friday. Okay. He'll be here Monday.
Thank you.
What?
So we're going to thank you, Representative Atkins. We're going to start the testimony from the general public. And first of all is Jessica Banks from Take Action Minnesota. And welcome to the committee. And would you give your name just for the tape?
Yes. Sorry. Good morning. My name is Jessica Banks, and I live here in St. Paul. My husband, my two young sons, and I are currently enrolled in Minnesota Care, and I'm here to ask you to ensure that the dedicated health care access fund for the Minnesota Care program is not used to fund the exchange, as has been suggested, as an alternate funding source. Health insurance companies stand to gain billions of dollars in revenues from our new exchange, so it is only fair that they fund the exchange with the moderate 3.5% of their exchange earnings. This is, by the way, common practice in other states. Considering the overwhelming amount of wealth the health insurance companies will get from the exchange, it is unfair, inequitable, and unnecessary to disinvest in Minnesota Care and ask Minnesota families to pay for it. I am opposed to shifting the Health Care Access Fund away from Minnesota Care because I know from personal experience access to affordable and quality health care is the difference between life and death. When we moved to Minnesota 2.5 years ago, neither mine nor my husband's jobs provided health care coverage. Thankfully, we qualified for Minnesota Care coverage as our income is below 200% of federal poverty. A year ago this month, my elder son, Connor, who has Asperger's syndrome, went through a suicidal crisis. Autistics like him and like me, for what it's worth, find rapid, unpredictable change overwhelming, and his baseline of everyday highs and lows crashed and became erratic and violent. He thought, at only 9 years old, that death was the only way out of his sensory and emotional torture. Our Minnesota Care plan covered his recovery 100%. The relief in knowing that there was a reliable, comprehensive stream of financed medical care during this crisis gave our family the much-needed ability to heal together and to help Connor recover fully. I shudder at the thought of what would have happened if we didn't have access to Connor's treatment. We celebrated his 10th birthday this past summer. It's all teeth and candles, if you can't see it from that distance. And that was a milestone that I honestly doubted at times that we would achieve. Today, he's the brilliant, happy, healthy child that every parent wishes for. My husband recently got a better paying job with a good health plan, so we will be moving off of Minnesota Care. But I'll always be grateful that Minnesota Care was there for us when we needed it, and it allowed us to work towards stability and something better. This is how the Health Care Access Fund and Minnesota Care work and should keep working. Please do your part and preserve the Health Care Access Fund to be used for access to affordable and quality health care. I also ask that you vote to uphold the finance mechanism and keep this bill intact. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Banks, very pleased to hear of the full recovery and what a great program Minnesota Care is that covered 100% for your child, and now he's in a full recovery, so praise the Lord on that. However, I hope you're aware that with under this exchange bill, Minnesota Care, which was drafted probably by some here in the room and improved over the years by some in the room, including our chairman, it's a great program to do exactly what we wanted it to do. And however, this exchange bill completely gets rid of it. Starts over from scratch with unqualified numbers and expenses and dark hallways, and I'm afraid it's going to do not what what Minnesota Care has done. And the 3.5% increase that tax to the insurance companies, although that maybe sound like a good thing, that the insurance companies are, they should pay more, they'll just pass that along to my companies and everyone else's companies, and they'll pass it on to the consumers. So it's unfortunate that Minnesota Care was such a great program, and now we're throwing it out.
My understanding is that part of the whole package under Minnesota's implementation of the ACA is for a basic health plan that will cover many of the people who are covered under Minnesota Care. There's also the Medicaid expansion, which I know has already made good progress through the legislature. And my understanding is that that covers many, many of the people. My family would fall with its income into what they call the bronze plan trap. But we would also be covered securely under the two things, the Medicaid expansion and the basic health plan that are being enacted as part of the larger health care reform that is related to but separate from this health exchange bill that is currently under debate. The other thing I would point out, and I'm sure other witnesses will tell you more about it, but since the healthcare exchange is an informed marketplace for consumers, for hundreds of thousands of new consumers, the insurance companies should see a big reduction in the amount of advertising that they have to do to cultivate new customers. And so they'll be making savings from that right up front, since the state exchange will help to do the job of marketing their plans to customers like my family and others.
Thank you, Ms. Banks, and I don't think there's anything in this bill that relates to Minnesota Care. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Just to mention something that Ms. Banks said in her testimony, that what you believe in the ACA or exchange bill will be covering what Minnesota Care is, that is not the case. Minnesota Care will completely go away. The exchange does not cover 100% of what Minnesota Care was, and that is why our Commissioner Jessen, has been traveling back and forth to Washington to address these very important questions. So when you say it'll cover completely what Minnesota Care is, that is not the case. Our own commissioner is very concerned about it, so what you say is not exactly accurate.
I wasn't saying that the exchange covers it. I was saying that there's the larger thing. Yeah.
And again, there's nothing in this bill relates to Minnesota Care. It does not get rid of Minnesota Care. So thank you for your testimony, and we'll go on to the next person, Ron Elwood, Legal Services. Representative Liebling, you have a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I hope it's okay. I wanted to address my question to Representative McDonald. Would that be okay?
Okay, but we have a lot of people to testify.
We do. I just wanted to ask him if he's so sure that insurance companies would pass along the extra cost to people. What if they, in fact, make extra money? Are they going to pass along the extra profit? Or how does that even out?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would love to answer your question, Representative Liebling, but unfortunately we have a lot of testifiers, and due to that...
I could volunteer to answer.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. And Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd certainly be happy to defer my testimony if you'd like to answer the question.
Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Appreciate the opportunity to testify here in support of House File 5. I want to thank Representative Atkins for his work on this bill. My brief remarks, I want to focus on the governance. And I'd like to suggest to you that we need to keep the Exchange Board free of self-interest. We really need an independent board, a governing board that's independent and objective. The board's decisions will affect millions of people and billions of dollars. And the decision makers cannot be made up of those who stand to gain financially. And I'd like to, we've heard a lot of talk about we need expertise on this board, where are we going to find it? And I'd like to just relate to you that 10 states that have already have active exchanges or at least have appointed boards have found a way to do it without having any self-interest at all. Almost all of the boards that are in place prohibit those who personally or whose business stand to gain to be part of the boards. And I'd like to give you some examples of the types of folks that they found all across the country to serve on these boards. Public policy experts from nonprofit, nonpartisan policy institutes, non-health plan, non-broker, non-carrier business executives from some of the largest businesses across the country, university professors in schools of public health, doctors, foundation presidents, retired health plan executives, hospital executives, the president of ARC, we have ARC here in Minnesota, public health experts, HR consultants, benefits experts, presidents of the Urban League, Citizens League type organization CEOs, heads of ethnic organizations and Farm Bureau executives. So I would submit to you that there's plenty of expertise in Minnesota as there is across the country, and I would urge you to keep the board free of conflict. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Elwood? I don't see anything. Thank you for your testimony. Next is Eric Haugi of AFSCME. Haugi.
Haugi. thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Haugi with AFSCME Council 5. We represent roughly 43,000 employees in the public sector, nonprofit, and healthcare sectors across the state. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today in favor of House File 5. We strongly support the provisions in this bill that will create an exchange that can act in the best interests of the public and consumers. And I'll focus my testimony today on the active purchaser provisions in the bill. We support the authority of the exchange to actively negotiate on behalf of consumers in order to get the highest quality insurance products for small businesses and individual Minnesotans. Would it be better to have the option to buy 500 apples, some which have worms and some which are hard quality? Or would you rather have the option to buy 100 apples that you know don't have any worms and have met a minimum threshold of quality? Minnesota has long prided itself on being a leader in healthcare reform, but we also know that the current insurance market does not work very well for individuals and small businesses. But there's a danger that without the active purchaser model, the exchange will have no leverage to improve the quality of products or to create incentives for other improvements in the market. The exchange could be little more than a cool website, and consumers may see no improvement in the plans that are being offered. Promoting choice just for the sake of choice does not ensure that Minnesotans will actually get quality choices. An active purchaser exchange will not result in arbitrary decisions leading to a market with hardly any options. If health insurance companies want to offer plans on the exchange, they will know exactly what they need to do, offer high-quality plans at a competitive price. And consumers will benefit from being presented with meaningful choices on the exchange. We know that people make better choices that are more in line with their own priorities when they have a manageable number of clearly defined options. If we want everyone to purchase insurance through the individual mandate, we owe them the option of the lowest possible price. If we're going to spend taxpayer dollars to subsidize insurance in the exchange, we owe it to taxpayers to get them the best possible value. Any business that wanted to offer a selection of plans to its employees would first negotiate with insurance carriers to get the lowest possible price. We should follow the example of other states like California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, and even Washington, D.C., and give our exchange the authority to act on behalf of consumers. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the 500 apples, some with worms, some without. I'll take the apples without worms. But in regards to the board, you know, from what I understand, the board will not have experienced folks on it. such as doctors, nurses, those in the professional health insurance agencies. There'll be a group of folks that don't have the necessary expertise. So this isn't a Travelocity kind of website, that it'll be a free marketplace. It'll be pretty much pushes out the private business partnership. So just curious as to are your folks going to be part of the board? And what your thoughts are on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we have not had discussions about if our folks would be on the board. I don't anticipate at this point that they would be.
Okay, other questions? Representative Allen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, you talked about the best interest of the consumer, mm-hmm. and can you talk a little bit about where that requirement comes from, that it's actually in the federal statute, and that and so you talked about how choice is that alone is not fulfilling that federal mandate to act in the best interest of the consumer. So is there, and so how do you envision that the exchange will act in the best interest of the consumer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, I would anticipate that the exchange would set some criteria to look at the plans that are offered within the exchange. Does that get at what you're asking?
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, you talked about how that in order for the exchange to act in the best interest, that it had to have the authority to do that. And so that authority, do you see that in the current bill? I mean, where is that authority, and how is that authority going to be exercised by the exchange to act in the best interest of the consumer?
Mr. Howdy.
It's my understanding that the bill as drafted would have the authority to look at the different plans that are offered within the exchange to, like I said, you know, weed out the bad apples.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, so you're not proposing any certain standards. I mean, we have had Representative Liebling has imposed certain standards for the exchange to act in the best interest. Have you taken a position on that?
We have not.
Mr. Howdy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony. Yeah, the you know, as far as people with a bias, as far as being on the board, I share your concern. And you know, the alternative is if we allow a completely free and open market in the state of Minnesota like we do with auto insurance, rather than building government bureaucracies that are going to decide which plans, when, and if they're going to be available to people, you wouldn't have to worry about that. The private market does for free what we're going to be spending millions of dollars on trying to duplicate with government bureaucracy. So does the board, as long as we're talking about the board, does the board is going to be free from activists or union leaders or people who helped develop the health insurance exchange on the as far as the membership?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm not sure the language as it's drafted right now. I mean, I don't anticipate that we would have folks on the board. I mean, we have not expressed an interest in that. So.
Okay. Okay, let's go on to the next testifier, which is Mary Jo George from AARP. Thank you, Mr. Hauge, for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. I, too, appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 5, and we'd like to thank Representative Atkins for all of his work on this legislation. As you may know, AARP represents nearly 700,000 members statewide, 44% of whom are between the ages of 50 and 64. And so for many of our members, the exchange is going to be really important because they do have a difficult time finding affordable health care coverage in the market today. Thus, we believe the development of an exchange that is consumer-friendly will be vital to those, not only to those who lack insurance, but it hopefully will improve the affordability for those in the individual and small group markets today. Moreover, it's through the exchange that the eligible consumers will be able to access financial support, when insurance is unaffordable, and these subsidies will be in the billions of dollars over the next decade, supporting both individuals and Minnesota's economy as a whole. And so we think it is important to state that some people will, in fact, see decreases in their premiums as a result of these subsidies and these market changes. AARP also believes consumers will best be served by the creation of an exchange that is large enough to alter the insurance marketplace and strong enough to foster active negotiations with the plan. Furthermore, we believe the exchange should carefully select and certify plans sold through the exchange using the same competitive market-based strategies that are used by large employers today. We think insurance plans should be able to compete based on cost, value, quality, and customer service. And in this important regard, the Minnesotans Exchange should work really for us as consumers and as taxpayers who are supporting the exchange. In conclusion, I guess I'd like to address some of your comments, Representative Allen, because while we are supportive of the bill, we would recommend that House File 5 be strengthened to explicitly allow the exchange board to have that power to select, certify, and decertify plans sold on the exchange. Our concern is, as the bill is written today in the subdivision on the health carrier requirements, that it looks like this authority is really contingent upon whether or not there is a market bill that is passed afterwards by this legislature. So we would like to see some explicit language that gives it the authority to set the higher standards. And so we could talk about that in more detail after this hearing. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. George? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mrs. George, I guess I have a bit of a concern when we talk about the board selecting and putting in these high standards and limiting who can participate in the exchange and controlling competition. I find this extremely troubling after last night's testimony from April Todd Melmoff, where she said that she thinks this entity, how it's different from a state agency, is that it will be competing with the private market in enrollment. And so as we go through all this process and give the board broad powers to opt out of all of these requirements and then limit who can participate while fully admitting that this group is intending to compete with the private market, does the public market have a chance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zerwas, I think last night maybe my interpretation of what April was trying to say was not that the board itself was competing with the private market, but that the plans, the private market plans within the exchange and outside of the exchange would be competing. And so that is good. To foster active competition within the market is good for consumers. That is good for small employers. And so we think it is all right for an exchange to use the tools that are available in the market today that large employers are able to use to negotiate, to set high standards. I don't think it's about limiting choice. I think it's about creating meaningful choice that provides better value.
Ms. George, luckily we don't have to have you interpret what Ms. Melmoff said. We have the quote.
Okay.
So when she was asked directly about, you know, why does the board need to be so flexible, what to expect for changes, Ms. Melmoff flatly said, I think this entity, how it's different from a state agency, is that it's competing with the private market for enrollment. And so that, along with your group's position of limiting who can apply, limiting who can participate, limiting the standards and controls, do you see an issue where what we're doing is we're orchestrating this entire situation so that only a few plans can compete, and oddly enough, the state-run exchange is exempted from a lot of those controls because it is competing with the private market for enrollment?
George.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zuras, I'll have to let April speak for herself, and I won't take that on. But no, I don't see a problem with. I really do believe that we do need to change this marketplace. It is not affordable for people today. I think the ACA has developed some very good market rules, and I think it is in the best interest. So we may have to agree to disagree on that.
Representative Zuras.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Ms. George, in what other marketplaces are you aware of where when you limit options and limit resources and limit availability, the price goes down?
Mr. Chairman, that is a very good question. I want to use the examples, though, that we use from the Veterans Administration today. Medicare doesn't have the authority to negotiate and then unfortunately spends a lot more in prescription drugs than the Veterans Administration. I think we could look at the purchasing power that the state of Minnesota does with our Medicaid contracts. We have implemented smart purchasing for those contracts, and we are seeing the price come down. We're seeing savings in our budget. So I do think that, and for large employers, I think that we do see that the price comes down with competition. I think that creates a robust marketplace.
Representative Zuras, but Ms. Malmov is here, and she'll be willing to answer questions, I would assume, this evening.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. You know, this goes directly towards what AARP is testifying for, so I think Ms. Michael here is a great person to address some of these questions, too, so if that's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think in one end you're talking about limiting and control and setting standards, and then at the end of your statement just now, you talked about competition in a robust marketplace. So why not just have a competition in a robust marketplace where if you have a plan that meets the standards, that meets the benchmarks of both the federal legislation and meets the standards of the board, let them in? Well, how does that hurt? How does that variety, how does that breadth of competition, how is that going to drive a price up and not down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zuras, I don't think we're too far apart the way you just described it. I really do think that one of the things that the Affordable Care Act gives us today is that plans will no longer be competing on avoiding risk, but rather they'll be competing on quality, they'll be competing on affordability, they'll be competing on healthcare outcomes. And so I think that is a good direction for the marketplace to go, and I think we're fairly close in what we're trying to achieve here, what you just described.
One last one, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. Ms. George, that being said, with how close we are, is it your opinion or is it AARP's opinion that if a plan meets those quality standards and meets those benchmarks, it should be allowed to participate in the marketplace?
Ms. George.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zuras, yes, I think there's some question, though, of what we're talking about. We think there's minimum certifications that were established by the ACA, and then we do think that the board should have the authority to create some higher standards. Now, having said that, it would be our preference that the board could also select among those plans based on, for example, we think that if there was an RFI proposal, you know, a request for information, a request for proposals, they may get that information back and make some decisions that are in the best interest of consumers. We would want to be very clear that that process was transparent and that that plans and consumers were able to provide input into that process. But I do think you want to create that flexibility because things could change.
Representative Zuras.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to close out here, let's just be clear. Your position is that if you meet the basic standards and you meet the standards set by the board, you still believe that the board should be able to not include that and to limit competition.
Mr. Chairman, sure. Representative Zuras, we would like the authority for the board to be able to select from those plans through an open, transparent process. Thank you.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, I have a comment regarding a statement made by Ms. George. First of all, I agree with your comments about the that the market rules are not designed to inhibit competition, and that but your statement about the that the standards giving the exchange the board authority to be an active purchaser and buy through having standards that where they will have some authority to do that to act in the to act in the best interest of the consumer, but you had stated that that was contingent on there being a market rules. And so that is that it's my understanding that that is optional, but it's also my understanding that that's going to occur, that there will be market rules, and that the purpose of those market rules will be to set standards and set the to so that the exchange is complying with the technical standards of the ACA, mm-hmm. and that and then also to clarify jurisdiction of the Commerce Department and the board, but it does not set those high it does not. Deal with those higher standards, and that you can have, and that it's what they're not mutually exclusive, and that, and so that even if there is a market rules, that we can still have an active purchaser that would act inside the exchange and impose higher standards. Thank you,
Ms. George. Do you have any response,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Allen? Yes, we agree with that. I think from our legal analysis of how the bill is drafted, however, we think it might need some clarifying to exercise that authority because of the provision before that says the board will not have the ability to establish certification requirements for health carriers unless the legislature, or they will have the power unless the legislature enacts the market rules bill. So I don't know if I've confused the issue, but we could talk about it afterwards. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll skip. The issue's moved on.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. George, I have a comment from Michelle Kimball from AARP.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that, according to AARP, her quote was, "We are concerned that if too many health plans are allowed to participate in the exchange, it could make it difficult for consumers to easily compare plans and make informed choices." Let me say that again. "We are concerned that if too many health plans are allowed to participate in the exchange, it could make it difficult for consumers to easily compare plans and make informed choices." Are you hearing what they're saying? Now, I Googled AARP, and there is over 10 pages for links to AARP. Each page has about 10 links. That's 100. And then when I Googled term life insurance under AARP's website, there are over 10 pages with 10 different links. Do you see the irony in this? Does AARP really know what they are saying? Now, wait a minute, I didn't ask, I'm not yielding a question. I mean, I'm not done speaking yet. I hope you folks realize the irony in that. That they're going to limit, they're in favor of limiting companies for performing in the exchange in the free market. And yet, their own websites has hundreds and hundreds of links, which, by the way, is very confusing for me to make an informed choice of which AARP website or link is important, let alone what is. That, folks, I know you don't agree with me because you like this plan and you want it to pass, but just think logically. It's so illogical. Now, if I was an insurance company, I'm a photographer, but if we were having this as a photographer's exchange and they limited it and I wasn't qualified or I wasn't even authored or allowed to qualify, I would be upset. And so would you folks if you were an insurance agent or if any one of your respective careers were limited from the biggest program that the state will have. So no questions have to be answered, Ms. Georges, but I want to just reiterate the irony that you support this out of 700,000 members in your organizations, which I bet, you know, that alone is complex. And think of all the 700,000 employees or members that ARP has. How many of those have insurance companies that won't even qualify for their own exchange? It's irony. It's disappointing, and I think you should reconsider exactly what you're getting yourself into.
Okay. Do you wish to respond, Ms. George, or not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just say, you know, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say, Representative, you know, perhaps we could have a discussion, because it is our understanding that, you know, we aren't saying we want to limit choice. We think everybody should have a fair shake in this, but they have to meet standards. And so that's what we're after. And our experience from the Medicare Part D rollout was that there were so many choices that what happened is CMS had to come back and set standards on cost sharing and to create different certifications, because in 1 year a plan would be there and then the next it wouldn't, because they didn't have, for example, solvency requirements. So I can't speak for the products that our organization endorses. We don't actually underwrite them, but from our policy perspective, we think this would be the best choice for consumers. And there's research to support that, and I'd like to share that with you at some point.
Representative Fisher.
Just in response to Representative McDonald about the irony of the AARP site saying it was overwhelming because there's so many choices out there, I think that goes to the whole point of wanting to have some control in the exchange here. The last thing we want is to have so many options out there that it's becoming overwhelming for anybody who is trying to use the exchange. I think the exchange board should have that opportunity to help make sure that it does not become overwhelming, but at the same time staying competitive with some meaningful plans.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, when I go to TGI Fridays, one of my favorite restaurants, the menu is a little overwhelming. But I like it, because it gives me a lot of choices, and a lot of choices are good. So perhaps you misunderstood my comparison to their website. I don't think the exchange will be overwhelming in that case when there's that many. But so a lot of choices are good. It helps competition, it drives down costs, and it has a variety of life. So just a little plug for GI Fridays, but no, it's overwhelming is not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay, we only have about 5 minutes left, Representative Grunheide.
Mr. Chair, I notice just generally when I'm about to talk, people always talk about short period. No, I'm just kidding. thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thinking ahead, Mr.
Chair. I'm maybe developing a complex, but anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. George, just one comment about your Part D drug plan. I have to sell Part D drug plans, okay? And there is a number of choices out there. Mm-hmm. And I found interesting your comments that, yes, CMS had to set standards for certification. I understand that. And there's standards for selling health insurance in the state of Minnesota. And there'll be standards for certification to participate in the exchange. The point is this. In the exchange, if you meet the certification requirements, the 7-member board can still vote you down. Okay? That's the problem. So you've got government bureaucrats picking winners and losers in the market. That has never resulted in better, lower cost, more innovation, and better outcomes. Yeah. Never has it done that. When you have so it's the active purchaser clause that had been a major contention with the chamber, with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and also with the insurance agent organization. Where 7 government bureaucrats, if you meet all the requirements, can simply nix your... And by the way, those requirements are going to cost millions of dollars to meet. And when they've met them, they can still be nixed by a 7-member board. That is simply anti-American, anti-free market, and will not produce the type of quality and lower cost and competition that we're seeking in this exchange. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. George.
Thank you.
We're going to have to move on to, was there another one there?
No.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think we'll have a more rich discussion of this as we go on, but I think there's some misunderstandings about, at least from my vision, of how we might make selections based on criteria that any plan can step up to meet if they choose to. It's not... I don't see it an arbitrary choice. I see it establishing objective standards that we have traditionally used in Minnesota. We could have an insurance company that would propose to be in our market and maybe not have an adequate network. So you sign up for their plan, and they may not have enough capacity in terms of primary care doctors for you to ever get care when you need it. That the exchange board could say, to be in this exchange, you have to have at least access to this many hospitals based in Minnesota. You have to meet some quality measures that are objective measures, that we use community measures, traditional things we've used in Minnesota for a long time. I think we need to think a little bit about what the type of selection criteria could be, and I think they should not be arbitrary and capricious, but they should be based on the consumer's best interest in making sure you're not paying premiums to something that never works for you.
Okay, we're going to go on to the last testifier this morning. She's from out of town, about an hour and a half drive. So, Ms. Mengskow?
Very good.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Toni K. Mengskow, and I'm from Rochester. I'm a constituent of Representative Lieblings and very honored to be here today. I work in cancer research, and I talk with thousands of patients every year that struggle with insurance issues, but I'm here today to, as a volunteer for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I'm here to speak in favor of House File 5, the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace Act, and to tell you how it would help my family. I'm listening to some of this discussion, and it's getting pretty technical here and there, sometimes a little dry, but I want to bring you back to why we're doing this. I want to introduce you to my family. I have a picture of my daughter, Valerie. This is Valerie. And I want you just to keep in mind that as I share my family story, we're talking about people. This is my grandson, Justice. Very unique name. Yeah. And I have my 10-month-old granddaughter, Faith. So my family story starts when my daughter was age 15. She has a history of chemical dependency and mental health issues, and to access the needed treatment, I relinquished custody to the state of Minnesota. She was a ward of the state until the age of 18, and this was the toughest decision as a parent I had ever had to make. But due to the inequities of the insurance coverage for these issues at the time, I saw no other choice. During this time, my son was diagnosed at the age of 16 with inflammatory bowel disease. He was bedridden for a couple of years, unable to attend high school, was on 22 meds a day and giving himself methotrexate injections. He needed a tremendous amount of care. With this pre-existing condition, he's been unable to obtain affordable health insurance. Because of his health issues, he wasn't able to continue as a full-time college student, and coverage through my employer ended. Soon after, at the age of 41, I had an abnormal mammogram and breast biopsy, which eventually led to a decision to have a double mastectomy. During this time, I was the primary caregiver for my 7-month-old grandson. I chose an aggressive treatment to ensure I'd be able to care for him during his early years. During the same time period, my children's father was receiving treatment for colon cancer at the age of 49. My children are at very high risk for developing breast and colon cancer. My daughter's to start her cancer screenings this March at the age of 25. And my son will start his cancer screenings at the age of 30. I can't imagine at those young years having to worry about going through cancer screenings because of how early it's shown up in my family. In the past, I accumulated a tremendous amount of debt trying to help my uninsured children with medical costs. And in 2008, I declared bankruptcy. I have no other resources to help my kids right now. My wish is for no other parent to have to relinquish custody of their child to obtain medical treatment. With the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there is now mental health and chemical dependency parity. My children will be able to obtain affordable health care coverage even with pre-existing conditions. They'll also be able to start their cancer screenings, which alleviates the fear of finding cancer too late. And again, cancer too late. And again, I hear these stories of cancer patients where the cancer is found too late. It's devastating. Having a health insurance exchange that puts consumers' needs first ensures that the plans available to me and my children are high quality and that we get the coverage we pay for. A board free of conflicts of interest means that the decisions made will put consumers' needs first, not the needs of the insurance industry. And enabling active purchasing will provide high-quality plans in the exchange that cover what families like mine need when we have a medical crisis. Today, I have coverage through my employers, and one of my children is back on my insurance. I'm able to somewhat sleep at night knowing that my daughter has medical coverage and is no longer having to seek care in the local emergency room. She's continuing to struggle with her mental health and chemical dependency issues, even after achieving 5 years of sobriety. Just recently, due to a relapse, I became the legal guardian for my 10-month-old granddaughter, as my daughter is trying to get back on track. I would ask members of the legislature not to forget about Minnesotans struggling with chemical dependency and mental health issues. Many of these individuals end up in our prison system, just as my daughter did in the past. She was 2 weeks pregnant when she was sentenced to a year in Shakopee for drug-related charges. Her phone calls at night were heartbreaking. She begged me to get better medical care in the prison system. When I visited, I cried because she was so thin and the skin literally hung from her cheeks. She was not getting the care that she needed during this time. I worried about the baby, what was going to happen. We could have had our own doctors follow her and provide care. We were told that if we provided transportation and security costs, that our doctors could provide this care. But those costs were in the thousands of dollars, and they were out of reach for us. I'm concerned about the proposed exemption for individuals in the prison system. As I've witnessed with my daughter, there's a lack of adequate medical care for this population. This is not only on the state level, but also in the county jails, as many inmates are being housed on the county level. I wonder about the impact on county tax dollars if this exemption is granted. The future exchange will hopefully benefit my family, including my son, who is now uninsured and in need of ongoing medical care. He has flare-ups, and the medications to treat these flare-ups are very expensive. I'm very grateful to Representative Atkins and to other authors of this bill for crafting an exchange that meets the needs of Minnesotans like my family. And again, I just want you to remember, we are real people. And I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ms. Manskow? Thank you very much for your testimony. And we're out of time, so we will be back. We'll recess until 1 hour after session today.
Was this thing broken?
The meeting is in recess.
I will.
I'll call the meeting back to order. And we now have the House File 5 in our possession. And so I would move that House File 5 be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. And I think the author is back there. My intent tonight is to go through the rest of the testifiers, and we can all ask them questions. And then finish up tonight. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will have the exchange staff here to make a presentation on both the fiscal part of the bill and then the rest of the bill, and we'll be able to ask them questions. And then we'll be back here on Monday morning for amendments and vote on the final bill. And we're going to get the new version of the bill, so you can spend the whole weekend reading it. And so let's start with the testimony. And first we have Chris Sneeman, Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform.
He cannot be here.
Okay, so he won't be here. And Twyla Brace, is she here? Well, if they're not here and they come later, we'll go back to them. Kate Johansson, she's here from the Chamber of Commerce. And are we going to start with Catherine, or how do you want to do it? Okay. Catherine Kmit's going to start first.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee.
Thank you. And members of the committee, my name is Catherine Kmit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which includes seven nonprofit health plans. such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Health Partners, Medica, Metropolitan Health Plan, Preferred One, Sanford Health Plan, and UCARE. I want to thank Representative Atkins for his work on this legislation and his willingness to listen to our concerns as this legislation has moved forward. We hope to continue working with Representative Atkins so that we can create an exchange bill that works for our community. Until that time, however, we still have concerns with the bill. The Council of Health Plans supports universal coverage for Minnesotans. Additionally, we support the creation of a state-based health insurance exchange that works for Minnesota. Like other stakeholders, we believe Minnesotans are best able to create an exchange that works for Minnesota. Our concerns with this legislation is that it will not produce an exchange that does work for Minnesota. First, we are very concerned with the language that gives the board the authority to decide which health plans can be offered in the exchange. House File 5 limits consumer choice. The exchange should be an open, competitive marketplace that entices both sellers and buyers to participate. The bill discourages interested, qualified insurers from wanting to participate. House File 5 limits a competitive marketplace and will not allow consumers to choose the best options based on their own needs. This is the government picking winners and losers in the private marketplace. Our question to you is, if a health plan is able to meet these high standards, then why wouldn't it be allowed to participate in the exchange? Here's why this matters. Under the active purchaser model, people who have coverage today may not be able to get the same health plan coverage through the exchange. This will affect people with health conditions who rely on particular providers in their network for their care. If the board decides which plans are in and which plans are out, people may discover the board did not allow their plan to participate in the exchange. Consumers will be forced either to continue with their plan outside the exchange and possibly forego the tax subsidies or go into the exchange. But if the board controls which plans are offered, enrollees may have to select something different, which could mean they have to select a new doctor or specialist. When it comes to purchasing health care coverage, typically the two most important factors are the cost of the product and whether or not my provider is in the network. How can a 7-member board possibly know what is best for every consumer? I also want to briefly respond to some comments that were made by an earlier testifier from AARP about the need for additional requirements to become a qualified health plan, and just let the committee know that Minnesota's health insurance plans are highly regulated. That's a baseline. And then to meet the federal standards to participate in the exchange, health plans must follow additional high standards. For example, one of the requirements in the Affordable Care Act for certification as a qualified health plan is that the health plan must have a payment structure that improves health outcomes through care coordination, chronic disease management, medication and care compliance, and the use of the medical home model, plus activities to reduce preventable hospital readmissions and the use of best clinical practices and evidence-based medicine. Additionally, the Affordable Care Act requires that a health plan must be accredited by a national body recognized by the federal government. The accrediting body will be examining the qualified health plan issuer for performance on clinical quality measures, patient experiences, quality assurance, provider credentialing, network adequacy, and access, and a number of other important measures. All of these measures taken together are meant to ensure that qualified health plans offered in the exchange are of high value to consumers. And one more thing about the board picking and choosing which plans get to participate in the exchange. The Affordable Care Act requires that two multi-state plans must be offered in the exchange in addition to the other plans that meet the state and federal qualified health plan requirements. That means that in Minnesota, we will have two multi-state plans that will also compete for customers on the exchange. The difference is that these two multi-state plans are not subject to the board's additional selection process. These two multi-state plans are subject to the regulations by the Federal Office of Personnel Management, not state regulations or benefits. So now we will have two multi-state plans automatically allowed to participate on the exchange, while the rest of Minnesota's local health plans will be chosen by some process set up by the 7-member board. That is surely an uneven playing field. The higher the board sets the bar for Minnesota's health plans, the more it will drive consumers to the multi-state plans. We also have concerns about the overall size and cost of operating the exchange. The fiscal note for House File 5 shows the estimated annual budget for operating the exchange to be in excess of $50 million annually by 2016. This is a lot of money. Those of you who have sat on the Health and Human Services committees in the past have no doubt fought hard to protect or find a much smaller sum of money for a project you knew would directly benefit someone or some group. We owe it to the stakeholders and the others who have looked to the state for support to give the same level of scrutiny to the $50 million budget of the exchange as we have given to every other request that comes before the legislature. Remember, none of the $50 million in the exchange budget will be used to pay for medical services, nor will these dollars be used to help pay for premiums for low-income Minnesotans to purchase insurance. These are the administrative dollars solely for the operations of the exchange. Our question to you is, do you know what you are getting for all of this money? This question was posed to all state agencies in a memo to them by the state budget director last summer as they began to build their budget proposals. In the memo, she asks agencies to explain, what are we getting for our money? The legislature needs to make sure what the exchange is budgeting for provides the best value for consumers. The justification for a budget of this size comes from the estimates of enrollment in the exchange. Those enrollment estimates are in Table 2 of your fiscal note on the bottom of page 6 and top of page 7. The fiscal note estimates a budget based on between 177,000 and 300,000 non-Medicaid enrollees participating in the exchange by 2014. We think these estimates are overly optimistic and need to be examined to make sure we have an appropriate budget and adequate funding. The enrollment estimates were produced from the report by Jonathan Gruber and Bella Gorman. They modeled enrollment for 2016, and then state staff had to figure out how these estimates would look in 2014 and 2015. That modeling was done before we had any of the rules or regulations from the federal government on the markets or products for insurance in 2014. We still don't have that information. The modeling was also done without any knowledge of how our state would develop an exchange. All of this is to say that the information Gruber and Gorman had to create these estimates was incomplete and in some cases non-existent. They had to work with what they had. However, this ought to require another review of these estimates as the exchange becomes more defined and more information is known about the implementation of federal reform. There are additional reasons to view enrollment estimates with skepticism. First, enrollment estimates for various new endeavors such as this are often wrong. For example, the federal pre-existing condition insurance plan, which is the federal high-risk pool, was created as part of the Affordable Care Act, and they estimated that 200,000 people would enroll in that. Actual enrollment was 20,000 people in year one, and after a series of significant changes to the pricing of that program, enrollment grew to just under 100,000 people today. That is 50% of the original estimate. The Massachusetts Connector is perhaps a more relevant example. Their budget was based on enrollment estimates that suggested that they would enroll between 60,000 and 120,000 individuals in their Commonwealth Choice program by 2009. However, by 2009, they had only 20,000 enrollees, or about one-third of their low estimate. Today, in 2013, they have 44,000 enrollees. I'm not sharing these numbers just to show how hard it is to accurately estimate human behavior, but to understand some of the reasons why these estimates fell short of reality. The second reason to rethink these enrollment estimates is affordability. I think this is a driving factor in whether or not people buy coverage. That's always been the case. In 2014, this will be true inside and outside the exchange. We know that because of the benefit changes required by the Affordable Care Act in 2014, premiums will increase. In fact, Gruber and Gorman have said that the premiums in the individual market will go up by 23%. Subsidies available through the exchange may bring down those costs for some, which is a good thing. But it doesn't guarantee that those costs will be less than they are today. As I look at the estimate for enrollment, particularly for the non-subsidized population, I don't think it reflects the experience we've seen in other states or what we've seen in this market. I think simply looking at the enrollment estimates in the fiscal note raised some real questions. We don't have an exchange today, we don't have the products, and we don't have any enrollees. Yet, we are budgeting $60 million for an exchange to have 175,000 to 300,000 premium-paying members in this undefined entity in less than a year. If the exchange can meet their estimates, that will be wonderful. It would certainly be a great success, and people would be accessing choices and hopefully subsidies that can help them afford their coverage. I think the best way to get there is to have an exchange with a budget that is efficient and can be measured as showing good value to the state and to consumers. But if the exchange fails to meet these enrollment estimates, there will be some serious questions. Most notably, if the exchange doesn't meet certain targets, then which area of the state budget will be used to cover the losses? As I look at the fiscal note, it appears you will need just over 200,000 premium-paying members in the exchange in 2016 to meet the budget. This assumes that those 200,000 individuals are paying the full 3.5% withhold. The low enrollment estimates for the non-Medicaid enrollment in 2016 is 293,000. This number assumes the state will not have the basic health plan, which we hope to have by that time. If you assume we have a basic health plan by 2016, we'll need to pull 30,000 to 50,000 people out of that 293,000 number. So now we're down to 240,000 to 260,000 people estimated for the low enrollment. You will need to make 85% of your estimate, and history tells us that that will be a significant challenge. Now, with respect to how the exchange is funded, House File 5 imposes a 3.5% premium withhold or premium tax, which will be collected from the health insurance premiums on products sold through the exchange. We strongly oppose this tax because it's unfair. This tax will fall disproportionately on individuals and small employers only, regardless of whether or not they use the exchange. And I meant to pass this out, but I think you've all seen this. Sure. This is the pie chart. Now it's in color. But this is the pie chart that shows where Minnesotans get their health insurance coverage. And the data from this pie chart comes from the Minnesota Department of Health. These are the numbers for 2010. And as you can see, the red area of the pie chart is the fully insured market. That's the segment of the marketplace that the state legislature has control over. The green part of the pie chart is the self-funded market. Those are the ERISA plans, the very large employers, and they are exempt due to the federal ERISA law from any state laws, mandates, state taxes, etc. The reason I'm showing this to you again is that in House File 5, the premium tax is intentionally built into the cost of health insurance as an administrative expense or withhold on the individual and small group premiums. State and federal regulations require a health insurer to blend administrative expenses among their products both inside and outside the exchange. Therefore, the cost of this tax is intentionally imposed on both individuals and small groups who use the exchange, as well as individuals and small groups who choose not to use the exchange. So I'm pointing this out to you because in this fully insured market, there are really three groups. They're the individuals, small groups, and large groups. This tax only applies to the individuals and small groups, whether they're inside the exchange or outside of the exchange. It doesn't apply to the large groups. Those are groups between 50 and 100. So it falls on a subset of the fully insured market, not the entire fully insured market. Insurance premium taxes are unfair because they are applied only on coverage purchased in the fully insured market. And as a result, coverage for individuals and small employers is much more expensive than coverage provided by the large self-insured employers. And I'm going to ask the page to also pass this out. This is a tax chart that many of you have seen already. Thank you. But this just shows you, this is looking into the future, what the tax impact will be once the federal taxes, the 3.5% premium tax, go into effect on top of the existing premium taxes in the market. And the two columns in the on the left and in the middle represent the fully insured market. One is for HMO products, one is for indemnity products. The column on the far right is the large self-funded employers. They still pay through the provider tax. They are subject to the provider tax because they're not exempt. So I want to be sure that you understand that if this new 3.5% premium tax is enacted, this inequity in the tax system will only grow larger. The exchange is not just for some people. It is for all Minnesotans. We view the exchange as a public good for the benefit of the entire state. As such, we believe funding for the exchange should be spread across taxpayers as broadly as possible. The funding mechanism should be fair, it should be transparent, and accountable to the legislature. We believe the current mechanism in this bill does not stand up to the principles of what makes a good and fair funding source. I also want to address Representative Atkins' request to find out how much will be saved by the health plans once the exchange is up and running. With respect to savings from Medicaid eligibility determinations, there won't be any. That's because the health plans do not perform this function. This is something done by counties and by the state. With respect to the elimination of underwriting, I can tell you that for 2011, the cost of underwriting was 0.04% of every premium dollar. That's not very close to 3.5%. Finally, with respect to marketing costs, the health plans are still going to compete for enrollees both inside the exchange and outside the exchange. The competition doesn't go away. Even if the health plans were to stop marketing to enrollees in the exchange, it would represent such a small number of their overall covered populations that it would not make much of a difference. We also have serious concerns about the composition of the board of directors and the conflict of interest language. Federal regulations expressly state that the exchange must ensure that a majority of the board members have relevant experience in the areas of health benefits administration, health care finance, health plan purchasing, health care delivery system administration, public health, etc. However, the bill does not require the board members to have relevant experience as required by federal law. Members of the Governor's Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Task Force are also concerned that this language excludes individuals with current relevant experience from serving on the board. Without the relevant experience, the board will be limited in its ability to make fully informed decisions. Finally, we are seriously concerned that the exchange will be ready for open enrollment on October 1st, 2013. Getting the IT systems up and running is an enormous and expensive undertaking, both for the state as they create these new systems and for the health plans to be ready to connect with these new systems. IT readiness is our biggest concern for the exchange. If the exchange cannot be supported by this new IT system, it will not be operational. The exchange will not work, and this is a real possibility. The key to making the exchange operational on time is to do what is minimally necessary to become operational. Features that are nice to have but not vital to the operations of the exchange can be considered later. The more complex we make the IT infrastructure now, the less likely we will all be ready on time for the October 1st launch. The goal of federal health care reform is to cover more people than are covered today. We wholeheartedly support this goal. The exchange is a tool to help us to achieve that goal. This is not about the inside market of the exchange competing with the outside market of the exchange. Rather, we should be united in providing as much opportunity to reduce the number of uninsured in Minnesota. Members, I urge you to avoid making the exchange overly prescriptive with limited consumer choice and so expensive that we end up with more people uninsured than we have today. We want the exchange to work in Minnesota. However, as currently drafted, we do not believe this bill will make it work. As a result, we cannot support the bill for the reasons I have just mentioned. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Commit. My question is, two. Number one, did I hear you correctly? And that's what I had read also. There'll be two plans nationally that will be automatically allowed into the exchange, and yet our own plans within the state are subject to the approval of the seven-member board, even if they qualify and are certified in every other way, and the board cannot reject those two national plans. Is that correct?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes, that is my understanding as well, and that is what I testified to.
Ms. Commit, does that mean that we have our Commerce Department has their rules, and then we're going to have the board have a certification level is higher? Does that mean that the national plans don't have to meet either one of those criteria?
Mr. Chair, I think what it means is that they will likely have to meet certain requirements, but they're different requirements, and they're requirements determined by the federal government. It's through the Office of Personnel Management that is going to make these decisions to have multi-state plans participate in the exchange.
And do they pay the 3.5%, whatever?
Mr. Chairman, my answer would be no.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Grenade.
Yeah, that's an epiphany, right? I think it just shows the fallacy of having the active purchaser clause in there. It discriminates against our own plans in our own state, and yet these two national plans, if I understand the testimony correctly, are not subject to that, and are not subject to the 3.5% tax on top of that. If I understood your testimony correctly, is that right, Ms. Commit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, they're not subject to state law.
And that's why. Okay, Mr. Chair, just one more.
Representative Grunhagen.
To the author, Representative Atkins, doesn't that trouble you to leave that active purchaser clause in there when it's discriminating against our own plans in our own state versus allowing these national plans to come in without that are not subject to our state laws or the approval of the board?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, of course it does. It would trouble me more if they weren't subject to the 3.5%. They are subject to the 3.5%. There are still some additional guidelines that are coming from the federal government. I know NAIC, on behalf of National Association of Insurance Commissioners, on behalf of all of the states, is concerned about the same issues. They will have to comply with certification requirements. We expect those to be appropriate certification requirements, and we expect that together with many other states that we will continue to seek from the federal government appropriate certification requirements.
And Representative Atkins, if you could just state your name for the tape.
Sure.
I'm sure we all know.
I'm still for the tape. I'm still Representative Joe Atkins, humble public servant.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your comment. You know, Representative Atkins, it's Valentine's Day, and if you would like the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, a nice Valentine gift for Ms. Commit would be to take the active purchaser out of the bill. I just see it as a way to bring a lot of support for your bill from the chamber, the business partnership, even the Agents Coalition for Health Reform. That's just a key, and plus it discriminates against our very own plans. Are you at a point where you're ready to consider that?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, the more times you make me answer the question, the more committed I am to not making any changes. So keep asking, Representative, you're getting me in concrete here, buddy. And I would mention, and thank you, Mr. Brickwitty, from the Department of Commerce, any plans that are sold in Minnesota will have to meet the Department of Commerce standards. So that's it's separate from the separate certification, but they will have to meet the minimum standards of the Department of Commerce as well. Thank you, Ms. Prickwitty.
We're going to have April Todd Malmov tomorrow discuss this. Apparently, there's a little difference of opinion between Representative Atkins and Ms. Commit. But Ms. Commit, you had a comment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me correct the record. Yes, Representative Atkins is correct. If you're going to operate, if you're going to sell products here in Minnesota, you have to meet the Minnesota requirements, the state laws, to be a licensed health plan. But what I'm suggesting is that the additional taxes and premium withhold and that sort of thing, we think that it just gives the multi-state plans an unfair advantage to be able to participate in the exchange. For one thing, these are probably going to be for-profit health plans, large multi-state plans, who have a lot more access to capital and are able to offer loss leader products and things like that. So I just want to make sure that people are aware of that.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit. First of all, I apologize for not being here earlier today. I know many of the members of the committee have been on previous committees and the stops along the way, so I'm just trying to get up to speed a little bit. And Ms. Commit, I'm just looking kind of narrowly at the Gruber-Gorman report, which I have and which you have referenced to a little bit in your testimony. And there have been several references back to that within the fiscal note and other spots about savings within this particular bill. But when I walk through that, again, and this is just kind of coming in fresh, I'm unable to find those savings within the report. Can you give me a little bit of help or talk me through that a little bit as to where I might be able to find some of the savings that has been referenced both in previous testimony and earlier committees this morning and also within the fiscal note?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, so I have a copy of the April 2012 report that was issued by Gruber and Gorman, and that's the biggest report that we have. There's a presentation that I think you're going to see tomorrow based on some later data that Gruber and Gorman put together. I believe that they're still working on drafting the subsequent report to this, but in this report, in this particular report under Table 17, it talks about what the effects are to household budgets as a result of the Affordable Care Act. And they do say that on net, households' budgets will rise because there are some people who are going to benefit from getting these tax subsidies. Absolutely. And so they will see an improvement in their finances, which amounts to about benefits of about $500 per household, but it's at around 150% of the federal poverty guideline. So further down into this report, it talks about above 400% of the federal poverty level, the benefits become negative, although fairly small. Even for the highest income groups, those with incomes more than 10 times the poverty line, the loss per household is $340. So it's not, some people are going to see a good benefit, definitely. Others may see more cost. So there's going to be quite a bit of transition in the marketplace.
Representative Dean.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit, understand that. Have you been told that the document that I have is titled The Impact of the ACA and Exchange on Minnesota, and it's dated April of 2012. Do you have a document that is newer than that, or is that the only document that you have?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, I don't know if I have it right here with me. I know there is a PowerPoint presentation that was presented to the task force, the Health Insurance Exchange Task Force, on January 11th. I think that's probably what you're going to see tomorrow. Maybe you have that PowerPoint. In that PowerPoint, that is using some more recent numbers that were developed once all those numbers went through their modeling system. And I can tell you that in that, in fact, it's in the fiscal note, the existing fiscal note for this bill. It does talk about the impact based on these more recent numbers will be in the individual market an increase of 23%.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit, that report that you have is a PowerPoint that's based off of numbers from a report that we don't have. Is that correct?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. I think the report is not ready.
Representing the Gorman Gruber, is that the name? They have sent our people the new projections in terms of numbers, but they have not completed the text that goes along with that. So all we have is basically their projections, but we do not yet have the text that would describe in more detail what these figures mean. And again, we'll hear more testimony on that tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit. I'll leave it here in the interest of time, but as a member of the committee, I would like to have whatever numbers the department has, the agencies have, or anyone on the committee has, the freshest numbers that you have that we're basing information off of. I would like in my email, yeah, in whatever form they are, in whatever raw state they are.
We can. We will hand those out either tonight or tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Both the updated one and the original 2012 report. And who's next here is Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions going to the administrative costs. Is I understand that there's a cost of $50 million the first year, and not too sure who's the best person to answer that, but from my understanding, that first $50 million for the first year, is that something we're paying for as through the state, or is that a subsidy that's coming from the federal government? How is that being taken care of this in the first year?
Well, I could answer that one, but I'll let Ms. Commit do it.
Be my guest, Mr. Chair.
The feds are going to pay for the operating costs during the first year. There is in the bill is up to, I believe, 3.5%. If the feds do it, it will be 3.5%. And that's to set up a reserve for the exchange fund that would be used in further years in case there are shortfalls.
So I'm understanding then correctly that's the federal government that's helping us get this established.
In the first year.
And then coming to the question of the 3.5% that I hear that's either withhold or coming through, Mr. Chair, am I correct that if those people that are eligible coming through the exchange are getting federal tax subsidies, those tax subsidies would also be helping pay, whether it's 3.5% or if we find out it's lower than that, the lower rate?
That would be correct.
Okay. And then if it was if I'm understanding correctly, if it's an add-on, and I've heard whether it's an add-on or the person buying it pays it as they go through, the withholding amount is something that, say, if the insurance company determines the rate is $100, they would just mark it up. If it's at 3.5%, $103.50 to be able to cover that 3.5%, then correct?
That would be correct. And I want to make everybody understand this. It's not the insurance company that pays that $3.50 in your example.
Okay.
It's the person or company that's buying the insurance.
Okay, thank you. And that's where there's some confusion on it. So it's the individual consumer. So it's really not the insurance industry itself that is being denied funds or collecting funds in the process. It's the individual. Okay, thank you.
And next we've got Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was actually from some time back, but it just strikes me as that when we're talking about these multi-state plans coming and being in the exchange, competing with our plans, there's an assumption that our plans are that the state-based plans, which will be under the active purchaser model, which will be sort of a select group, selected perhaps for certain improvements they might be willing to offer to Minnesota consumers. There's an assumption here that those plans wouldn't be able to compete. And I just wanted to challenge that assumption because, and we're not solely talking here about money. I mean, NISCMIT kind of addressed that after I had raised my hand by saying that there could be loss leaders and that kind of thing. But they are still going to be regulated by the Department of Commerce, which looks at rates. And I just think that the assumption that somehow Minnesota's plans wouldn't be able to compete with these two multi-state for-profit plans, everybody's assuming that. I would assume that consumers would prefer the plans that the exchange would select, because the exchange would be selecting them on the very basis that they would be somehow in the better interest, in the best interest of consumers. So I just want to challenge that assumption. I think those multi-state plans might find that there isn't so good a market for them in Minnesota.
Ms. Kmetz.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, thanks for the question. I think what I'm probably wasn't too clear on is that we're going to set up a system where everybody has to meet the requirements, the state requirements by the Department of Commerce, all the state laws, and then there are going to be these QHP requirements. For the plans that are here in Minnesota, they are going to have to meet a third level of requirements that we don't know, because the board is going to develop some criteria and select which plans they want. There is going to be a competitive disadvantage because the multi-state plans won't have to go through that process that the board establishes, because they're going to be selected through the federal government. The federal government is going to tell us what plans those are.
Well, Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, it just strikes me that maybe the word competitive is, maybe we mean different things by the word competitive. By competitive, I mean that consumers would probably prefer the plans that are selected by the exchange over the plans, the multi-state plans that are in there without that selection process. So, I don't know, maybe miscommit means something different by competitive, but I just don't really see any reason to assume that the Minnesota plans that are selected by the board are going to be somehow at a disadvantage. In other words, that consumers will come into the exchange and say, well, we've got these hand-picked plans that are the best for Minnesota consumers, but no, I want the multi-state plan that is outside of that process, which is presumably no different than anything they could buy elsewhere. I just don't really see that happening.
Representative Abler. Oh, wait a minute.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I think that where there could be differences is on price, yes, and how much things cost.
Good.
And I think that people who are shopping in the exchange will look at cost and also look at, is my doctor in their provider network? Mm-hmm. But especially for people who are younger and healthier, who don't use the system very much, they may be far more attracted to a plan that is the cheapest.
Mm-hmm. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Ms. Chair, and actually Ms. Todd Momoff took off. I have, when you finish the witnesses,
back.
I
want to be here tomorrow too.
But I won't be here tomorrow, so I hope I can ask you some questions tonight. So
you have another life?
I do. I like this life, though, Mr. Chair, especially if I can be with you on Valentine's night. I do have one comment on this topic, though, which is perhaps germane. So just to this discussion here, so the out-of-state plans, I was just waiting for a copy of the new bill so I could read that, but that's still coming. We're getting copies. Okay, but is that in the bill, or is that just the federal law? Do you know that? Is that... I can't read that in the bill about these two plans, right? These two national ones. Is that in the federal law?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, it's in the federal law.
Okay. So I won't read that in the bill anyway. Never mind. But about these two plans, so they're going to have to do normal commerce approvals and whatever federal laws, regulations there are. Oh, she's back. I was going to ask you a question later. Ms. Todd Malmoff. These two plans are going to have to meet the normal solvency requirements of the state and all that, but they won't have to do whatever enhanced requirements the governing those, this board is going to set up. Is that correct? They're not going to have to meet all these extra bonus. Maybe Ms. Todd Marlowe can ask. Ms. Todd Momov, we're talking about these two national plans, and maybe you can just, there's been a few different opinions expressed, so I thought maybe you could tell us what you know, maybe you get to be the tiebreaker. It seems like everybody has to pay the 3.5% or whatever the fee is to serve. They have to meet, and these two plans that are from out of state have to meet commerce approval and then whatever federal regulations, but they wouldn't have to meet the special whatever the board adds on for their enhanced standards. Is that right? Or maybe you can just talk about that.
And Ms. Todd Momoff, if you would also give your name for the tape. But I'm also interested in, do they have to meet the criteria for certification? Ms. Momoff.
Mr. Chair, April Todd Momoff, the Exchange Director, and Representative Abler. So to your question, I'm going to phrase my answer in two parts. The first is the base market regulatory requirements, so licensure, community rating, guarantee issue, all of those things that apply kind of market-wide. The national plans need to comply with each state's regulations in those areas, and Mr. Brickweedy can probably talk in much more depth about that than I would, because that's in Commerce's scope. What we received a few months ago were proposed rules from the federal government or from OPM on how they would deal with the multi-state plans that would go into the exchange. And so within 4 years, in every state, there would be two multi-state plans in each state, one that's a for-profit and one that's a non-profit. Within the first year, they don't have to offer in every state, but at the end of 4 years, they would need to offer in every state. And they would be allowed to operate in those exchanges when they come into that state. In terms of the certification requirements, we're still waiting for the final rules on that, because today they're just proposed rules. But in the proposed rules, they would need to comply with all of the certification requirements that are there. There is still some uncertainty as to which one of those may be determined by OPM and which ones would be determined by the exchange. So there's still some back and forth there on that. One of them, for example, around network adequacy, there's been some discussion back and forth with them as to whether or not they would have a standard or they would comply with whatever the standard would be for the state. But they do need to comply with all of those standards. So we don't yet have the final rules on that, but are expecting those probably by the end of March.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, in the proposed rules, they would not be given any special treatment about criteria they had to meet, then? Is that summarize your answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, they have to meet all of the categories of the certification requirements. How those are actually specified, OPM may have a different specification than the state would have. We just don't have the final rules on that yet.
So, Mr. Chair, they might be lower, they might be the same. So they might not have to meet as many. There might be an advantage to not have to do a few things that the in-state plans have to. That's possible?
That is possible.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I have a number of questions about other topics, so do you want to go on to somebody else, or do you want me to ask one more question? Is that all right? For Ms. Todd Momoff?
Are they for her?
Yeah.
Well, as long as she's here.
Okay. Well, I have several, but I'll just stick with ones that were kind of. So we're talking about this 3.5% thing. Mm-hmm. Could you move that thing? Randy, can you move that microphone? It's driving me crazy. The one there, it's just weird trying to look around. I'm kind of visual, and like, I feel like I'm hiding behind a tree here.
Yeah.
With this active purchase at 3.5% thing, let's say we have an active purchaser, we have 3.5%, and Blue Cross, Medica, and health partners all decide to participate, and maybe some others. And so at the end of the day, you pick just two of those. I won't burden winners and losers here. That'll affect probably texting and tweeting that goes out about who I picked to be winners. But so you pick two of them. Two of them get picked by the board because they were so special. And they're all special, Mr. Chair. They're all my favorites. So you pick two of them. Anyway, so Commerce has regulated all three. They've established their pricing. They've added the 3.5% to their products, and which will probably affect the products outside the exchange too, I think. And so now you have three products that have been certified. They're all ramped up their pricing to get the 3.5% thing figured in, and only two get picked. Now, the one that didn't get picked, are they going to have the benefit of not having to pay the 3.5% to anybody because they're not in? And so is that going to be a windfall to them? And maybe, do you understand the scenario? And I've given a kind of a broad picture, so can you help me understand that? And also in that, if you can help me understand, if indeed the 3.5% that they have to charge in the exchange can be spread evenly throughout their whole bit of business. So that's a long question. I know you understand it, so thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, so the 3.5%, as written in the bill, would apply to those plans that are participating inside the exchange. So if there's a plan that's not selected, they wouldn't be paying that 3.5%. The guidance that we've gotten from the federal government on how the 3.5% applies is for a carrier that has business in the exchange, the 3.5% would apply to them. They get to determine how they would distribute that within their book of business. So as an example, they may have, within the exchange, they may have lower administrative costs because they're not doing certain things like premium processing or looking at eligibility for employees within a small group plan, some of those types of services. They may not be doing that, so they may have lower administrative costs on that particular product than they would on a product outside the exchange. So they can distribute that 3.5% however they would like to. If they decide to distribute that 3.5% across their entire book of business, depending on what the distribution is of business that they have inside and outside the exchange, that could equate to, you know, less than 1% on their book of business if they spread it, you know, over their entire book of business. Just depends on how they decide to distribute that.
Ms. Kerr, thanks. Just to follow up, and then I'll...
Representative Abler.
Well, this is very helpful. And so when Commerce approves rates, are they approving the rate on a two-tier basis, that if you get to be picked and if you don't get to be picked? Is that how it's going to go? Because when they approve the rates, that's my question. I'll just quit there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, they would be looking at, I would assume, the actuarial soundness of the rates and doing the rate review to determine what that would be. But for consumers, if it's the exact same product, the exact same product inside and outside the exchange, it would need to be charged the same premium to consumers.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair,
I'm
not trying to drag this out, but so how about the company that wasn't picked? And so they got approved to increase they're going to have the same product in and out. They like their product, and they already sell it, and they're going to do the same thing inside the exchange. To accommodate the 3.5%, let's say they can't absorb that, they're going to have to raise the price of the exchange product, which they'll spread throughout. So they're going to get a point and a half bump on their whole product line to cover that. But now they aren't picked. What happens to that point and a half? Do they just get to keep the money?
Todd Malmoff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think there could be some a little discussion as to when the process of selection actually occurs. The process of selection could occur before the rates are filed with the Department of Commerce.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton had it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just was going to try to move us back to what we were kind of here for tonight, which is getting through the testifiers. I guess... That was my understanding, that we would get through the testifiers and that we would have these folks with us for the next 2 or 3 days that we need. And I kind of thought we were getting off track. So I was just going to try to draw us back there if we could. Representative Abler.
We just have a few testifiers left, and I don't think they were going to spend too much time. So Kate Johansson, if you would come back. And we can get back to these other folks either later tonight or tomorrow, Ms. Johansson.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employers, 80% of which are small businesses eligible to participate in a Minnesota State Health Insurance Exchange. Thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight, and thanks also to Representative Atkins for his work on this legislation. As many of you have heard me say before, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has long supported the legislative creation of a state health insurance exchange. We appreciate that this is a work in progress, but we do not support the bill in its current form. It's interesting to note that perhaps the Chamber is the only group that represents entities that develop insurance, sell insurance, have to accept insurance to deliver care to people, and most perhaps importantly, consume insurance. There are consumers. Those are our small businesses. And I think that Ms. Kmit's testimony was sufficiently comprehensive to reflect the issues that cause consternation for all of those groups. Out of respect for the committee's time, I would simply state that the chamber really underscores and perhaps adds an exclamation point to the issues that she raised. Based on the most recent conversation, I would add only one other comment with respect to the active purchaser language, which is that if we're not going to get concrete federal guidance as to how this would impact discrimination against Minnesota plans until the end of March, adding that language might be premature until we have some guidance to know how that would actually impact our market and some very large businesses in Minnesota on which consumers rely for plans. So with that, I will be here always. You will never be rid of me, and I'm happy to take questions now or whenever you have them. Thank you.
This is the same.
Thank you.
Zero, Representative Zero.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. just a few questions, Mr. Hanson, about kind of this active purchaser model. As we look at that and the limitations, so we don't overwhelm consumers with too many choices, we limit the options and really limit the supply. What do you think the effect of implementing that type of process is, where the Health Insurance Exchange Board really chooses winners and losers and who will participate? What do you think the effect of that is on the Health Insurance Exchange participation by the multitude of plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I think that there are three primary effects that active selection or active purchasing, whatever you call it, has on consumers, and that is where our focus really is. And first, I think it limits choice. There's no getting around that. And I think supporters and opponents and people who've never heard of it, once they have it explained to them, would agree this is just choice limitation. And the small businesses that I represent want choice. They benefit from choice. They want to be able to go and shop for plans that meet their needs and their resources, and they don't need someone to prescribe a choice for them. They need someone to empower them to make good choices by providing information and tools. And I would say that it also potentially has a second problem, which is that it disincents plan participation. I think Ms. Kmit properly and effectively explained the research and development that goes into developing these types of products. It is a costly, time-intensive process. And without knowing that even if you, in complete good faith, try to develop products that meet criteria that have been established to protect consumers, you still might be arbitrarily excluded from a marketplace. There's not a lot of good business sense to put those products together. And then third, one issue that active selection has that is particularly dear to a lot of small businesses that the chamber represents, nearly 2,000 small businesses, is that this could dampen incentives to switch to a defined contribution plan. Small businesses routinely state that budgeting for healthcare is one of their top three challenges. It is unpredictable, it is expensive, and they are very interested in the idea that they would be able to let their employees shop for themselves. An exchange could empower that, but unfortunately, an exchange with very few products doesn't incent people because you're not allowing the diversity of choice that would make that a palatable employment benefit. So I think that those are three potential problems that active selection would pose to consumers particularly.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Hanson, thank you so much for the answer. And you have a business background, you're with the chamber. Do you have any other model in which, when you limit options, limit choice, limit supply, price goes down?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I do not.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Ms. Johansson? I don't see anything. So let's go on to Beth McMullen from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Welcome to the committee, and state your name and take.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. We're an association of CEOs of Minnesota's largest employers. Our members employ over 400,000 Minnesotans and 4 million people worldwide. While the companies I represent generally self-insure for health employee benefits and are too large to purchase through the exchange currently, we're interested in creating an exchange that will add value to the healthcare system in Minnesota. I appreciate Representative Atkins bringing forward this bill. And as the Chamber stated, the partnership has also supported the creation of a Minnesota state-based exchange from the since the passage of the ACA. So we would like to see a state exchange that can deliver exceptional values to the individuals, those consumers of our health care here in Minnesota, that in terms of cost and quality and choice. I also won't take up the committee's time and will just say that essentially ditto to the testimony that you've heard from Catherine Commit and Kate Johansson. I would like to take just a moment, though, to address something that we've heard in testimony previously in terms of how the exchange might be able to do what large employers do in the marketplace. I think there's a little bit of a misconception. The large employers that I represent, as I stated before, generally self-insure, which is a bit of a misnomer. They self-fund for health benefits. So they do not, there's no insurance. They hold the entire risk for their population, with some exceptions about reinsurance over a certain amount. But I would say actually the members that I represent don't have reinsurance. Mm-hmm. How does this make a difference? You've heard that large employers have a lower cost and they're able to drive better value. One, I'm not sure that there is that much of a cost difference, and actually large employers may actually pay more on behalf of their employees. There's a thing called the Cadillac tax in the ACA, and a lot of large employers are looking at having to reconfigure their health plans so that they're not subject to that Cadillac tax because their benefits are so rich and so large and so expensive. So large employers, they self-fund these benefits for a couple of reasons, to provide uniform benefits across states. Companies that employ people in 2, 3, 4, 50 different states, ERISA allows them to provide that uniform set of benefits across the states without having to comply with various state regulations. And as the charts that Ms. Commit handed out show, they're also not subject to the state taxes. That is another piece of this puzzle that, you know, if there is a cost difference, they're saving money because we're not subject to the state taxes and regulations. Employers create a benefit set that complies with some minimal federal mandates, but then they create a benefit set that will be that will help them attract and retain employees. They also do other things to help hold down their costs because, again, remember, this isn't insurance. They're holding the entire risk for this population, their employee base, and their families. They do other things that don't show up in their medical benefit costs, such as wellness programs, gyms in their businesses, and so forth. So there are a number of things that large employers do that this exchange is not going to be able to do in order to drive the value, which, you know, I'm not sure if value is perceived as a higher quality or lower cost or some combination thereof. I think most people think of it in terms of an equation of cost and quality. Just along with those flexibilities that I mentioned, those are the things that really drive the ability of large employers to hold down their costs as compared to the insured market. So I just wanted to kind of paint that picture a little bit broader for the committee. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. But as Kate, I'll be here.
Could you just very briefly explain the Cadillac tax and what the penalty is? And for people on my side of the aisle, that also includes a lot of Taft-Hartley plans.
Yes, it does. You know, Mr. Chair, I can't answer that off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to do a little research and get some information to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much for your. Wait a minute.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Question for Ms. McMullen. I'm wondering. I think you referenced something about that 3.5% tax that's being applied, and I'm wondering why that is when the federal government is paying for the funding as of right now in this upcoming year. I'm trying to understand that a little bit. If you could walk me through why that's still being applied if right now the federal government is covering those costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that you're referring to the The exchange creation right now has received, I believe it's $100 million plus of grant money. I don't think I'm getting that, so I'm right on that. So there's grant monies to help set up the exchange, and it will pay for the first year. The operational costs are of the first year are included in that grant money, but I'm hoping there's heads nodding behind me. So I think, you know, we are concerned about the 3.5% withhold tax, whatever you want to call it. I think there is a question as to when does the state funding for this actually need to kick in? I do believe that for approval by the feds, the exchange has to prove that it can be a self-sustaining for its operating funds. So there is a need to create a funding source for this. There's no question about that. Our concern is the current way that the funding source is financed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is for you, Ms. McMullen. It sounds like you have the same question, and if this is for tonight or maybe tomorrow, but if somebody could speak to that in terms of when this would need to start kicking in, when those grant dollars expire, and when Minnesota has to start paying for the operation of the exchange, that would be helpful to know.
We'll certainly get that information tomorrow.
Okay.
If you're here.
I'll be here.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. McMullen? That she was the final testifier, unless Representative, or not, let's be getting late. Ms. Bray is here.
No, I'll be out to dinner.
Here. Okay. And so would somebody like to move the minutes of the...
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move the minutes of
February 13th. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I did notice that I moved the minutes last time because my name was spelled correctly, and in the minutes where it says that I moved the minutes, my name is spelled incorrectly. So that would be great.
No luck for this show.
It happens all the time. I spell it wrong half the time, too, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
Yes.
So, Mr. Showalter would... The Showmaker.
Shoemaker.
It didn't get late.
Spell correct.
As she moves the minutes.
All in favor?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. So the minutes as amended are approved. And you pointed out that that's the key thing in every one of these minutes. Okay. So I think we'll adjourn for this evening. Representative Abler's got a few comments or questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can't be here tomorrow, and I thought we had the potential to go to midnight if we had questions. But I certainly have some questions.
Well, you go ahead and ask the questions.
She's not...
As long as they're of the people that testified.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought we had time to discuss the bill and ask questions. And to of staff who's here, and part of the concern about the time, I'm not trying to be a jerk here, but I have some bona fide substantive questions about how this is going to work. And we have a little, I don't need to drag it out a long time, but I've... And so we have 3 hours on Monday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you won't be.
Plus whatever tomorrow is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So can I just take a stab at my questions?
Take a stab at my
questions. All right.
Questions.
Maybe if Ms. Todd Momov could come. Because I don't, anyway, so could she could come up. I want to ask about adverse selection and life in the exchange and out of the exchange. And that's a significant topic that we have not addressed. And can you, and I'm not sure people are aware, one of the ideas about having universal rules is there's no adverse selection. That's one of the arguments about making all the rules in Minnesota subject to the rules in the exchange, which is a great concern of mine, and I'm not persuaded that's a good idea. And so, Ms. Todd Momov, could you just help me understand how you think adverse selection would be here if we impose all these standards on Minnesota, all the fully insured products, or just leave them in the exchange. Could you comment on that, please? And maybe I'll follow up with something clarifying.
Ms. Todd Momla.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. So I think I'll discuss a little bit about some of the discussion that was that happened in the adverse selection work group and at the Exchange Advisory Task Force. I think as you've heard once already, one of the top recommendations from the Exchange Advisory Task Force around adverse selection was that whatever the regulatory requirements are, certification rules, regulatory requirements, whatever you call them, but whatever the rules are for carriers, that they should be the same inside and outside the exchange, have a level playing field, whether that is licensure or it is marketing standards or disclosure of information to consumers, consumer protections, network adequacy, whatever those standards are, they should be the same for all carriers so that they're all playing by the same rules. And that was one of the...
Are you talking about insurance plans outside the exchange that are not part of the exchange, not the equivalent one, or just the ones inside the exchange and their identical one outside the exchange?
Talking about just the market as a whole, both inside and outside the exchange, that the recommendation was that those standards, those minimum rules, should just apply to everyone in the same way. And in terms of the consistency of the market rules, some of the pros and cons of that were discussed at the adverse selection work group and at the advisory task force was that the pros of making them the same is that you have a level playing field so that everyone is playing by the same rules and that there's really no incentive for carriers to attract plans outside the exchange. There's no incentive for gaming by the carriers both inside or outside the exchange. We also have some experience in Minnesota that we had some actuaries that were on that that adverse selection work group, and we were looking at the history of MEEP. And so the history of MEEP is that you did have different rules inside MEEP and outside MEEP, and really you had that program went away because the markets were so different and premiums were so different in that market and attracting different groups that they thought that was very important to learn from that experience. The other provision related to adverse selection is that, as I think we all know, one of the provisions in the ACA that will reduce or mitigate the risk of adverse selection is risk adjustment. And so risk adjustment is there to kind of balance the risk of the carriers and the plans that are both inside and outside the exchange. The closer that the rules are inside and outside the exchange, the more accurate risk adjustment will be. And so that will be better to balance that risk if the rules are closer to each other. If they're further apart, risk adjustment won't be as accurate. And risk adjustment is a science. It's very new. I think any actuary that you talk to or economist that you talk to would say that the top and bottom 20% of the risk under risk adjustment doesn't get adequately accounted for. And so the closer you get things and the closer you make the rules, the more accurate risk adjustment will be accounted for. And so the closer you get things and the closer you make the rules, the more accurate risk adjustment will be. And then one of the other pros that that came from the adverse selection work group was that it eliminates confusion for consumers. And so if consumers and employers have one base that they know this is what the rules are, then they're not confused about if there are differences inside or outside the exchange and what they should be looking for. So creating some simplicity for consumers would be very helpful. In terms of the cons, one of the cons that came from the adverse selection work group, and this was really the big one and the only one that people looked at, is that they said that if the rules were too stringent, so if the market rules were so stringent on the carriers, that it could limit innovation and product development and participation in a market. And so the adverse selection work group, they agreed that the rules should be the same, but they shouldn't be so stringent to stifle innovation. And so the desire there was to make sure that everyone was playing on the same and level playing field, but have the rules at a level that would encourage innovation and that high level of competition that we want from the carriers.
Mr. Chair, perhaps to Representative Norton's point, Ms. Kmit could come back down and comment about this. Would she? Is she still here? Or Mr. Griffin there? But just my take on this, and I'll listen to what the witnesses say, is that part of the arguments are simplicity and consumers can't figure things out. My concern is that if we change the rules outside, inside, the whole market's going to be in turmoil. And I'm trying to help make this bill actually function. I'm trying to bring people together and find something that's functional. You know that. And if you disturb the whole world outside the exchange, that would just adds to the complexity and the risk of more problems. And maybe Mr. Griffin could comment on that from his point of view. And but I think this is a pretty significant topic that, it's worth a little bit of time. So thank you.
Mr. Griffin?
You can go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. Happy Valentine's Day. I represent Preferred One, and I'm speaking on behalf of my plan, not on behalf of all the other plans. But, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would ask you not to have the rules inside and outside the exchange the same. We don't think that's necessary. Mm-hmm. And this idea of adverse risk is one that's puzzling to me. And I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around how the exchange is at risk. The insurance carrier is at risk for the loss of premium based on medical loss. And I don't believe that the exchange is in the business of taking risk. And so when you mix those insurance concepts up, I don't think you're talking about apples and apples. You're talking about two different things. So I'm really puzzled as to the interpretation that's being given to risk and how that's being discussed in the insurance world tonight. There are concerns about who is going to be inside and outside the exchange. I think it goes back to the discussion that Ms. Commit was having with Representative Liebling earlier in the evening, and that is, how are people going to make decisions about what they buy? And if past experience is any indication of future behavior, they are going to make it based on what the price is. Price is what drives people's insurance purchases for the most part. And that's the area that we need to concentrate on. That's the area that the Commerce Department regulates to make sure that we have plans that are solvent, that have benefits that are the same, and will work. So I'm not sure that I can speak on behalf of what the task force subcommittee did on adverse selection. We do have a representative that was a member of the plan, and we would like to have him come and talk if that's what we want to discuss. But I wanted to get that on the table for the committee members. And Representative Abler, I'm not sure I've answered your question, but that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. I would like to remind people, but you can go ahead. I'm not trying to interrupt you here, but I don't believe there's anything in this bill related to the exchange that talks about anything except the plans offered in the exchange and the identical plans offered outside the exchange. There, I don't believe there's anything in this bill that says anything about the rest of the out of the exchange market.
And Mr. Chair, and I understand that.
I realize there may be a bill coming up after this to deal with that.
And Mr. Chair, the reason it's germane, I'm not arguing you as Speaker to rule on germaneness, but the reason that I think it's a worthwhile discussion is because if the rules should be equalized, then this exchange board and who's ever there are going to be the ones to decide what happens outside. So that's kind of the main thing. So I'll limit my questions to a couple more. Ms. Todd Momoff.
Let me say,
Go ahead. The chair.
You are on a very important topic.
Okay.
And we need to understand it, because I think that bill will be coming up eventually.
Yeah, thank you. And so, Ms. Todd Mama, from your view, or what you know, do you see the bigger risk of people fleeing the exchange products because of adverse selection or being drawn to them?
Ms. Mama.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think probably the more likely scenario is that those not eligible for the subsidies would have an incentive not to participate in the exchange, if the rules are not the same.
Go ahead. And the result of that would be that there would be more lower income people in the exchange getting the subsidy. And since health status is directly correlated with income, you would end up with sicker people in the exchange
than outside the community.
And Mr. Chair, people who are also enjoying the subsidy would, you know, that. So maybe I'll just ask one more question about the risk adjustment stuff then, which we haven't talked about very much either. So, and we don't know this, but we would think the people, if it's driven by money, the people who have their voucher are going to want to go to the exchange, especially if it may have some benefits based upon the board making extra things available there. So, so Ms. Todd-Malmark, so when you do, it's the data question, so when you're going to risk adjust me and my friend here, how are you going to know to add on more for me because I have something that he doesn't have or vice versa? And then the second question is, who's going to know that data? But first, how do you pick? Is it based on our how much we spent last year at the doctor? When you risk adjust us to decide if we're going to get a bump to Mr. Griffin's company, if he insures me?
Ms. Todd-Malmark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, this could be a long discussion if we want to talk about the specifics of risk adjustment.
Just the thematic.
The schematic, okay. So so essentially there's going to be a risk score based on the population that are in particular products and different metal levels. That'll be adjusted by the different rating factors that are there, and the risk score is actually tied to like a spending amount, so how much is spent on a person based on their risk score. One of the important component pieces of that is actually related to provider rates and how much is spent on that and the providers in a network, because that determines quite a bit kind of what the spending is. And so from my understanding of what the federal government will do around risk adjustment, there will be some type of a normalization around some of those provider rates to kind of get a sense of risk mix that's normalized to provider rates. So if you do have rules that are significantly different inside and outside the exchange, for example, related to network adequacy, you could have a risk adjustment system that isn't exactly accurate to account for those if they're significantly different based on that provider amount that would deal with that risk score.
Mr. Chair, but so aren't you going to, don't you based on how much I spent last year, or isn't there some individual information that you're going to have to, I mean, we're not the same age and we're both good looking, one of us. But I mean, isn't there some personal, individual data in that? I'm not trying to trick you. I don't know the answer to the question. Don't you? I mean, we're three different. Let's say we're all the same age, and got a woman and two men. There's probably, and isn't there somebody different? Don't you score us somehow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, from Minnesota's perspective, we're not doing risk adjustments. So one, I want to be clear about that, that we've deferred that to the federal government. And how that is essentially working is the carriers are actually going to be calculating those risk scores and sharing them through a mechanism, the average risk scores with the federal government for risk adjustment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, if I could just give a little different viewpoint from the exchange director. Thank you, Phil Griffin, Mr. Chairman. I don't quite agree that this idea of risk adjustment is a science. There's nobody at this point in time that is doing anything that is good risk adjustment. We're just entering into this world. And the plans have been trying to work with the state in terms of risk adjustment on the Medicaid population. We're trying to do it as a plan with CGIP. Everybody's intrigued in this, but if you want to sit down and have some interesting negotiations to participate in, talk about sitting down and sharing risk in a new type of mechanism for payment, whether you call it an ACO or a medical home, or even just the payments that we're trying to do with providers. We are not able to drill down into the individual and determine whether or not they have good risk or bad risk, depending on what their genomic makeup is or what their past health care is. These are very broad, blunt instruments that are being used at this point in risk adjustment.
Mr. Chair?
I just have one last question, then I'll be done.
Okay.
And so, realizing these are really some key parts of this stuff, so I appreciate you putting up with this. Just the Ms. Todd-Malmark, do you think at the end of the day, whenever this gets figured out, whatever data gets collected about Jerry and me is going to stay in Minnesota? Is there a way to devise it so that, I mean, people have asked about that question too. Is that it would, whatever we do could be contained in your exchange council and health plans in Minnesota, like the other stuff currently is? Is that anything to worry about?
Ms. Todd-Malmark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, as the structure currently sits, for risk adjustment, those scores will be calculated by the carrier, so I would assume that stays in Minnesota. I don't know if I'm answering answering your question, but
I just wanted to know.
They would not be saying Jim Abler has such and such a disease. They would say so that personal ADD. Information would not get to the exchange. The personal information would stay within the health plan.
Thank you. This has been very helpful. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, can I just agree with you very vehemently when you stated that the market rules bill is a very important thing, and it's part of what's making the Council of Health Plans and my colleagues and I nervous. If you come with a market rules bill that says things are the same inside and outside the exchange, you've handed a whole lot more power to the exchange board that now has the ability to choose who the carriers are inside and outside the exchange, and a whole lot of other things that concern us about how that bill is going to be coming. And quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, I'm surprised and disappointed that that bill is not here at the same time this bill is here. And I understand the difficulty that the exchange staff has in trying to prepare, as we all are, as this avalanche of rules and regulations is coming down from the federal government. But the rules to the game are not being set at a time when we can make decisions. And it's going to be very difficult for plans to decide what they do in terms of preparing for this. We don't turn these plans on a dime. Setting up the IT system for doing the exchange is a big deal. And I listened to one of the witnesses talk this morning about the money we'll save by having the enrollment done by the exchange. And I just looked at them and said, think back to 1984 when we moved to prepaid medical assistance and we got the tapes from the state and we couldn't use them. So we had to do hand enrollment. That increased dramatically the cost of enrollment rather than saving money. And those are the kinds of IT lifts that we're trying to do in a very few short months. It's not simple. It's not the fault of the exchange or the staff or the author. It's the time frame that we're working with. And quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, you and we all ought to be petrified.
Okay, we have three legislators that want to ask questions. First is Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's not so much a question, I think, but maybe it's to confirm. In the discussion about the advantages of being in and out and who would choose to be where, you know, what I didn't hear was a discussion of the small business person who wants to offer decent health insurance to their employees. And now, and most small businesses have people at a variety of levels and pay scales. And it's likely that in most small businesses there's going to be people who will qualify for the premium assistance. And so that, I think we just need to note that that's a really strong incentive for participation in the exchange, because that's the key to the access to that premium assistance. And that the majority of the people, at least as, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but my understanding is that, you know, the majority of the people, 50 to 60% of them will be MA enrollees. A major portion of the remainder will be people who qualify for these premium subsidies. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to make health insurance affordable for some people who may not be able to even take up their employer's coverage right now because the premiums are just above what their pay scale can offer. So I think it's going to allow some employers to have more of their employees participate in health insurance and take care of their health that right now aren't able to just because of the way the market is working for them, and they're going to be able to do it without having to increase their take-home, you know, their pay scale, their wage scale. And so I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of factors that are going to influence whether people choose to be in the market or not, and it's not just about those other things. It's also about the access.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
No, thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just hoping to add a little bit of clarification to the risk adjustment discussion. I have done some reading on that. It's really a modified form of underwriting is what it amounts to by the insurance companies, and it's supposed to be done on a whole. The concern is that whether inside or outside the exchange, and probably with it in the exchange, costs are going to start to get out of control. And because of unhealthy people gravitating to the richest plans. When that happens, there'll be a greater and greater demand for personal medical information to evaluate what's going on. So although the exchange, you know, is supposed to do a risk adjustment on the whole, ultimately when things start getting out of control, the demand is going to be to see the medical records and see what's really going on and where these costs are driving, either by the plans or the boards in Washington, D.C. or wherever to start making decisions on how to control the cost. And ultimately that leads to somebody deciding, based on your height, your weight, your age, and whether you look good, how much treatment you get.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Todd Melmoff, one of the things, I know you're going to be here tomorrow, I will be here tomorrow. One of the things I'm going to be asking about is the Gruber and Gorman analysis. I asked about it a little bit earlier, and I was handed a PowerPoint with your name on it as the Executive Director of Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. It's undated, and it's updated Gruber and Gorman analysis of ACA and exchange impact on Minnesota. What I will be asking about is this the only information that the committee is going to have before being asked to vote on this in the fiscal note? If so, I will be asking for the updated analysis that was used to produce this. If not, if there's another report, I will be asking for that and the cross-reference to the fiscal note. Also, the contract review within the Department of Administration for that contract, what portions of that were completed after the initial report, and what portions were used within this updated report, and how the finances are changed. So if you can think about that, maybe have a staff person do it between now and tomorrow, then I'll save probably some committee time. But I will be looking for that before I will be want to vote on this out of this committee. I think that we should have that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so maybe a little bit of background about the study itself would be, I think, helpful for this committee. I can address this in more detail tomorrow as well. But we contracted with Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman to do essentially an initial study of what the impact of the ACA would be on Minnesota and the exchange. And so that involved some modeling methodology that has been developed both by Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman. That modeling entails thousands of lines of code that are included in a pretty sophisticated micro-simulation model. It includes getting Minnesota-specific data. We worked with all of the carriers in Minnesota to submit information on premiums and enrollment and risk mix on all of the products that they offer in the state. We also got that similar information from our high-risk pool and also similar information from the Department of Human Services as well for that study. That information is used in conjunction with a survey that we've conducted in Minnesota for many years called the Minnesota Health Access Survey. The first time we did that report, all the data was based on 2009 data. And so that's the report that came out last April. What we also then asked Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman to do was to update those results. They have not changed the methodology. They have updated the results with 2011 data. So we got updated data from our 2011 household survey, updated data from the Department of Human Services, from MSHA, and from the carriers to update those results. And so those are the results that are presented in the slides. We had asked Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman to get us information as soon as possible. We told them to prioritize the results instead of just the text that goes around the results, given that the methodology is the same, so that we had the most up-to-date information to use for session and for the fiscal notes. And so we expect to have the text around the report by the end of February, but we wanted to make sure we could get the results to members for session as soon as possible. But I want to stress the fact that the methodology is the same. It is just using updated information for those results.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I didn't want to belabor it. I just thought if we could save a little bit of time for tomorrow, we'll talk about it tomorrow, but I just thought if we could save a little bit of time or maybe some staff time, that might be helpful. But thank you, and we'll be chatting about it again tomorrow morning. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question then for you. I have several, but will Ms. Todd Maloff be here on Monday to address some of the questions?
She's nodding yes.
And how about, like, some of the other testifiers, Ms. Commit or Mr. Griffin? And will the author of the bill be here Monday?
Is he awake,
Representative Atkins?
Where else would I go?
Okay. Right. Well, out of respect for St. Valentine's and those who want to get home to their Valentines, I will not go through a list of the fiscal note. Have you seen the fiscal note for this? It is going to take the weekend just to digest it, and I have many questions regarding this in correlation with Ms. Commit's draft here of the 9% uninsured and the fact that the Gruber GG, let's just call it the GG report, says rates will go up 26%, and yet the author says things are going to go down and saving health care costs. So those are the questions that I will hopefully address in more time on Monday and giving everyone the opportunity to go home tonight. Does that sound good?
Good to me.
Yeah.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask a question, but I fear for my personal health. but I do have, but I won't be here tomorrow, but there are two topics that I think would be prudent to discuss of those who are here. One is the readiness of the IT. There is, Dr. Gold's been here and hasn't been able to say a word, and but one of the big concerns that a lot of us have is that you push the button and it doesn't light up and nothing happens on October 1st. And the phone rings and there's no place to send people. And that is, in the best of cases, a challenge. And it would be productive, I think, for the committee to hear that, and I can pick up what is told. And the second question that could be discussed, I think, would be productive, which I won't ask tonight, Representative Norton, is about incentives for the exchange group to be leaner in their pricing. And that would be something to talk about just to help the committee understand where the money goes, and if they're willing, that would be, I think, productive. So, Mr. Chair, I want to also thank the staff, all the exchange people and Representative Atkins and all the people. They've had their own little club, Mr. Chair, and they're going home far too early for what they're accustomed to tonight. You can write a little, you can have a reunion sometime of all the people that have worked on this.
Pay them over.
Anyway, just to acknowledge that.
Representative Abler, I just got to tell you that I came into work this morning and I punched the on button on my computer. And after a minute or two, it comes up and said, failure to start searching for the problem. And an hour later, it was still doing that.
Oh.
So that is a serious problem. So I think it's I think we'll adjourn now, and I will say I think this is one of the more productive meetings we've had. Lots of good questions and lots of good answers. I want to thank the testifiers and the staff people because I think we learned a lot. Now we can go home and think about what more questions we have. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.